Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Arr!
Today is May 4th, 2013, and today we are doing Episode 27, Crash Course, A Brief Introduction to the World of Fighting Games, Part 1 in a series of 2. But first, I'd like to introduce you to a very special guest we have here in studio today. With us today, we have Jason from the NPCs Only podcast.
Hello.
So, Jason, I've obviously known you for like 20 years, but obviously many of our listeners may not. Let's be real, most of them do. They've probably met you in real life, but let's pretend that they haven't. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the moment that you first knew you were a gamer?
That was way back in the day, like a Nintendo generation. I was playing Final Fantasy, and back in the day, you know, you played a bunch of games. Maybe like Zelda was the first game that was a little bit longer. I was like, okay, and played Final Fantasy. First time you fought Garland, the first boss, you know, right? That was,
yeah, Garland.
Yeah, and you know, I was so excited. I beat him, like, yay! And it's like, wait, there's more. And I got excited, but I was also confused. I was like, oh, I have to beat this game. Ironically, I never did.
By the way, I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing because I knew what you were going to say about the Garland thing.
Yeah.
I want to clarify that.
Yeah, no, I think that was a really great little trick that Square played on everyone. I almost called them Square Enix. They weren't Enix yet.
They weren't.
Yeah, I definitely had that same experience. The first time I played it, popped it in, it was like, wait, this game's not over yet? Like, I thought this game was like 5 minutes, just like every other game that exists now.
And it hooked you, and it hooked me, and it's just, I think that's why Final Fantasy became such a big concept as it is.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, you contrast it to other console RPGs that existed at the time, like Dragon Warrior / Quest, which, you know, it was a longer game than most of its time, but still was much shorter than the first Final Fantasy.
Yes.
Okay, so that's great. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you guys do on your show, NPCs Only?
NPCs Only is a podcast about game, like pen and paper gaming, from the GM-DM perspective.
Excellent.
So, and what kind of stuff do you talk about?
We talk about basically creating worlds and kind of interacting with your players, kind of like when to kill players off, when to not, and to respect the people that you're gaming with.
Please don't kill us off when we do our game tomorrow, by the way.
I have to say, I think it's really great that you guys do a show like that. I think that there's a lot, like, I think there's a real need for resources for new DMs / GMs.
I mean, especially myself, Captain Spike and I are both pen and paper fans, but I've personally never DM'd before, so that sounds like exactly the type of show that would be helpful for someone like me, so.
I mean, basically it's just giving experience and basically what to do, what not to do, and kind of giving you kind of like from our experience. Like,
well, that's excellent. I think that you guys are putting together a really great resource
definitely.
There. I know you guys are young yet. You've only done a couple episodes, but I really look forward to seeing more from you guys.
Yeah, and speaking from experience, Space Pirate Ben and our friend Jason here, both great DMs. So.
Which reminds me, as is the local custom in our port, we are hereby rechristening you for the night as Sea Wolf Jason.
Oh.
Anyway, getting back on track, let's get in a few updates on some of our recently visited and revisited topics. I can't talk tonight. Why don't you start us off, Slagkick?
All right, so if there's anyone out there who actually is into Smart Glass...
There's probably not.
You can now get it if you're on Kindle Fire, if you're the type of person out there who's into Kindle Fire.
You're probably not.
So, that's cool, I guess. I still haven't even really played around with Smart Glass, just because, I don't know, I haven't really seen anything that, for me, is personally compelling about it. Like,
yeah, I think the only good Smart Glass integration I've seen so far has been with the Xbox Karaoke Channel app. Outside of that, it basically...
Yeah.
I've talked about this a little bit here on the show. It has enormous potential, but I really don't see anyone using it.
I almost wonder if at this point they're just using it to experiment for the next Xbox.
That would be interesting. Next up on the list, we have news from GameSpot. that a 25th anniversary PS3 exclusive bundle, Metal Gear Solid Legacy Collection, has been confirmed for release in June. This package is going to include Metal Gear Solid, Metal Gear Solid 2 HD, Metal Gear Solid 3 HD, Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker HD, Metal Gear Solid The VR Missions, and Metal Gear Solid 4 Trophy Edition.
I'm a little bit pissed because I just, a couple months ago, bought everything Metal Gear on PS3, since I just got my new PS3.
If it makes you feel any better, it didn't include VR missions, because this is going to be the first time that's available, as far as I know.
I'm excited.
I bet you would be. You're a pretty big Metal Gear fan, right?
I love Metal Gear. If you know anything about me, I tend to get ADHD and hardly finish games, but Metal Gear Solid 4 and every Metal Gear I actually finished. So
that's awesome. Have you played Peace Walker?
No, actually, I haven't.
Excellent. This will be a good time for you. That's a great game.
Can't wait.
You want to take? Oh no, actually, I want to take this next one. Metal Gear Legacy Collection is also going to include the graphic novels on the disc of summarizing the events of Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2, in case you bought them but don't want to play them.
Yeah,
I have no idea why anyone would want to do that, because they're so great.
Yeah, no, they're all...
Yeah, maybe if it was Mass Effect 1, but...
Rude and incorrect. Mass Effect 1's really good, you're just
Mako
basic.
Missions.
The problem is you, not the game.
Sorry. Not sorry.
Anyway, moving on. You know, this is a story that we've sort of been following through its development since day one. We finally have the results from THQ's IP auction.
Yep.
So, without getting too much into the details, Homeworld, the entire IP, is going to Gearbox, which, you know, maybe that's where all of those Aliens Colonial Marines dollars went. The acquisition of other IPs.
Game was so...
Speak into the mic. It's okay to be derisive.
No, I was just saying that game was, yeah, no.
Yeah, it's a freaking mess. And do you know how much money Sega paid Gearbox? Like, there are lawsuits being filed.
I know. I was about to say, yep, people want their money back.
They're like,
because...
oh, let's just get Homeworld with this money.
Well, exactly.
I remember looking at, you know, the screenshots originally when it first came out, and it looked really nice. And then looking at screenshots from the final product, I'm like, where did this come from?
Yeah, I feel like these lawsuits are frivolous, and, like, y'all are entitled, you need to sit down. In this case, I actually really do think there was a bait and switch. Like,
yeah,
it was really inappropriate.
It looked like a beta version of the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I've never personally played the Homeworld games. Is Gearbox a good fit for them?
Not really my kind of game, so I couldn't tell you.
I have nothing really important to say about this.
If anyone out there in Radioland is a fan of the Homeworld series, let us know what you think, if Gearbox is going to be a good fit for them.
Is Gearbox a good fit? I kind of probably think not, but that's because I'm biased against Gearbox right now, because I used to be really looking forward to Aliens.
Have they made any, like, I don't know off the top of my head what Gearbox
Borderlands.
Oh,
and
well,
Borderlands too.
You know, to be fair, Borderlands is cool.
I like the Borderlands games,
it's
actually.
It's a nice niche genre. I mean, it's a shooter RPG, and it's great.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I enjoyed the first Borderlands, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just think that they sort of have their heads up their own butts a little bit, and I don't know that they really needed to be buying new IPs when, you know, they're having a really hard time turning out a quality product that isn't a copy-paste of their most successful game of the last 5 years. I'm talking about Borderlands, obviously.
So,
anyway.
I want to talk about these a little out of order than we originally intended, because I want to save the fate of... Darksiders and some of the other ones for last.
Well, then you steer this discussion then, bitch.
So, the Drawn to Life series went to 505 Games. And that's cool. You know, I'd probably rather play Scribblenauts, but that's just me.
Yeah, I really don't think that Drawn to Life has any reason to exist anymore, if I'm just being really real. But Jason, I seem to recall you really enjoying Drawn to Life. What do you have to say?
I did enjoy Drawn to Life, but I don't think... Did they make sequels afterwards? I really liked the first game.
There was
game,
Drawn to Life and Drawn to Life the Next Chapter.
See, that's how much I paid attention to.
Wasn't there also, like, a SpongeBob special edition?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, but as... Slagkick? Slagkick mentioned, basically, yeah, I think Scribblenauts took it over that genre. I think really it grabbed it, turned it into something else, and really there's no use for Drawn to Life anymore.
It's redundant.
Off the top of my head, I can't even think of what 505 Games has done.
That's what Google is for?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head either. So, moving on, why don't you talk to me about Darksiders?
Well, the most surprising one for, I think, a lot of people is that Nordic Games not only picked up Darksiders, but also Red Faction, MX vs. ATV, Titan Quest, and some unannounced games that THQ had. The thing that's interesting is that apparently Nordic has been in talks with THQ since January. They're looking at sequels, but apparently a Darksiders sequel is not going to be rushed out, which is good news, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the Nordic folks, and I have a feeling that this acquisition was either to flip the Darksiders IP and resell it, because I feel like I had read that they had spent something like, what, $5 million for all of these licenses?
Yeah.
I really feel like most of these licenses are worth a couple million. So I really think that a lot of them are probably going to be flipped.
Interesting.
That or Nordic is going to license them out specifically to studios that are independently interested in them. Because, you know, you look at Nordic's portfolio, and they've pretty much only published, like, shovelware on, like, portable consoles. Like, they're not, like, a real full-fledged publishing house. They're more of, like, a holding company for assets. So I don't see them making Darksiders games, but it is in their best interests to see the license taken advantage of, because otherwise, or the IP taken advantage of, because otherwise, why buy it?
It's an industry. It's to make money. Simple as that. It's a great series, and I think that if they send it to a great developer who can actually turn it into and evolve it from the second one and turn it into a really good game, they just hold to make money, and that's what it's about.
Yeah, well, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about this on the show, but there are studios that are really passionate about wanting to work with this intellectual property. Most specifically, the one that we sort of really root for here on Game Buoy is that Platinum Games from, you know, you're probably familiar with them through Bayonetta, wants to make a Darksiders game.
I think it would do a good job. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's what you want to be. That's right now in the character action genre, Bayonetta is sort of the high water mark.
Yeah. One little note tying to the Drawn to Life acquisition, that only sold for $300,000.
Ooh.
Burn. I can almost buy it.
Right? And I looked into 505 Games a little bit while you were building that up, Slagkick. They primarily publish some games that are actually pretty popular. They don't develop, obviously, but they publish games in the Busta Move and Armored Core series.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Ironically, I just looked that up while you're looking up, too.
And I know you, so I bet Armored Core stood out to you.
And I was like, hey, Armored Core, holla.
Some of the later Wild Arms games a few years back. So 505 is legit. I bet they'll at least get it to market. Oh, also, they've published Cooking Mama games with Majesco.
Oh, okay. Good fit, then.
They'll probably make that work. They'll probably find a way to make money on that and hopefully get good product out.
Maybe a crossover Cooking Mama Drawn to Life game.
I'd play it.
I think a lot of people would play something silly and cute.
I think
like
that would be a good fit. So, up next, we have a what the fuck moment.
You can take this one.
The Dead Island Special Edition that we talked about that had the severed torso in a bikini and just blood everywhere. Even though Deep Silver apologized for it, it's still included in the special editions for Europe and Australia. That's disgusting.
Yeah, I really have very little to say about this other than I'm really disappointed to see that this is actually a thing that people are able to buy and have been buying. You know, this news sort of hit more than a week ago now, and there have been reports widely on the internet that this is a thing you can go to the store and buy. I just think it's really sad. It's, like, so gross.
I mean, the thing is that it makes their apologies seem insincere.
Well, that's my real primary concern, is that they made a big deal about how insensitive it was and how deeply sorry they were.
If they really felt that strongly about making a mistake, then they should have just taken action and pulled it.
Well, go back what I said earlier. It's all about money, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Did you see this thing?
I didn't. I actually have seen it. And I was like, who would want to buy that? I mean, but there are people clearly who want to buy it, or it wouldn't have been in the special edition. Of course they're going to apologize. They preemptively did that because they knew it was like, oh, we're sorry. It's a bad and tasteless. But you know what? They're still going to sell it because they produced it. They have probably a billion of them in their warehouse, and they want to ship it. And it's all about money. I know that's not what people want to hear, but seriously.
No, you're
sad
absolutely
truth
right.
Of the matter. You're absolutely right.
Captain Spike, you probably want to talk about this next one, huh?
I do. I actually have a series of about four updates that I think are all more or less going to be one-sentence updates. So I'm going to get those off in rapid-fire style. Feel free to interject if you have any comments. First up on the list, we have Devil Survivor 2 Break Record, coming out for the 3DS in Japan. We already know that. We've talked about it here on the show, how excited we are for this game. But it's going to be releasing July 11th.
Hashtag Year of Atlas.
Hashtag Year of Atlas. Next up, we have Nintendo's Miiverse has gone live on PC and mobile formats. So you can, right this very moment, in fact, if you have a Wii U and have a Wii U account, for Miiverse all set up, you can sign on your PC or your mobile phone, your iPhone or probably Android. I don't have an Android. I haven't tested it. And log into Miiverse. Check out some images and even get direct saves of your images and stuff that you've drawn.
Yeah, it's browser-based, so I assume that Android is fine.
I've done it, so.
It's a beta version, so there's still room for it to grow. But it's cool that that's gone forward as planned.
Yeah, I don't really know how it could grow. It worked like 100% good for me.
I didn't spend a lot of time with it, but I didn't see any option for me to post a new post.
That was the only thing I was going to send you.
Oh.
Yeah, I couldn't see it.
I don't know if that was never intended. But
I wouldn't expect it to be intended, but because then people would be using tools that aren't their 3D, their Wii U pad.
True.
But yeah, that was the only thing I was saying. I couldn't post or respond, actually, I don't think.
Now respond, well, no, surprised still.
I didn't really check, but I think I couldn't respond.
Could you yeah stuff?
Yes.
They probably don't want people making images and uploading them and, like, putting dongs into stuff. Like, actual pictures of dongs and not just...
I was thinking more of a text chat action rather than drawing.
Yeah. Oh, huh. Although, it just occurred to me, I know you can screen cap images on Netflix using the message tool. You could probably put on, like, some, like, softcore gay erotica and send pictures of dudes making out. That probably goes against Nintendo's guidelines a little.
Anyway.
Next up, we have
what you're doing next.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, sorry, guys. You need to get out.
You sounded a little too excited about that, Captain
This
Spike.
Is lights off, pants off night for me.
No!
I'm talking about after you leave. Jesus. Next up on the list, though, we have an update on Shantae on the 3DS Virtual Console. The much-loved Way Forward game will be released on the Virtual Console via eShop at the tail end of June.
That's great.
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot on the show. I'm really, really excited for this. I love that series. I feel like it doesn't get enough recognition. And now that 3DSs are finally a popular thing to have... I think that this game might finally have a chance at getting out of obscurity.
Yeah, and I mean, it's going to be a pretty good summer for Way Forward with DuckTales coming out, too.
Yep. And talking about AAA games that we typically don't really talk about here on the show, I just wanted to point out that Watch Dogs has been given a release date. It's going to be releasing November 19th, and it will be available on the PS3, 360, Wii U, and PC formats, as well as being a launch day title for the PlayStation 4.
Which doesn't necessarily mean that that's launch date for PS4, but...
No. In fact, to me, it almost certainly indicates that it will not be, or else it would have just been included
with the
rest.
You know, the funny thing about Watch Dogs is that I was looking at our E3 show notes a couple days ago, and I had forgotten that we weren't really into Watch Dogs when it was shown at E3 last year.
Yeah, well, now it's like, now that we know what the game really plays like, it's like Assassin's Creed with hacking and cyberpunk.
On Watch Dogs front, how I feel about it, it's like, I think it's all right, I think it's great, but the one thing that really made me happy is Wii U. I think there needs to be a lot more AAA games on the Wii U.
Yeah, no,
definitely.
I'll probably double dip and buy it on Wii U and PS4 once that version comes out, because I'm a day one PS4.
Me too.
I kind of figured you would, because you're you.
Yeah, I just want to say is, like, I'm glad that AAA games are giving love to the Wii U, and basically that I think it's a wonderful system that people need to support, simple as that.
That is the Game Buoy consensus as well, so you're in like-minded company here.
And I'll go ahead. I could rant on for this, so let's go.
All right, so I don't remember if it was last time or the time before, but we talked to you about New Etrian Odyssey Millennium Girl, which is a remake slash reimagining of the original Etrian Odyssey, which I guess I never played it, but I guess it really didn't have a story, so they added a story to it. There's going to be a classic mode, which is more of a traditional Etrian Odyssey experience. I don't really have too much to say about that specifically, because my experience with Etrian Odyssey is playing the demo of Etrian Odyssey 4.
Yeah, I'm really excited. The classic mode is still going to have a lot of the features from the new game. It'll basically just be stripping the game down to sort of storyless, more of a wizardry-style game, Jason.
Oh,
okay. This is basically the new wizardry.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. My impressions of Etrian Odyssey in general is that it reminded me very much of a Dungeons & Dragons adventure.
Yeah. Do you have any experience with wizardry, Sidekick?
I don't think so, unless you showed it to me once, and, like, I just didn't realize that's what it was.
Quite probably not. Yeah, but it'll be exciting to play sort of older scenarios of Etrian Odyssey with stuff like monster skills and you know, your captured monsters and the new stuff they're adding. So I'm really excited.
Cool. I think it'll be a good jumping in point for people who maybe didn't quite jump in on Etrian Odyssey 4. Or who missed those limited edition prints of 1 through 3 that they were doing recently.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like you're really going to want to talk about this next one.
I figured you were going to say that. CNET did an interview with Eiji Aonuma, who, of course, is the Zelda guru since the 90s. And he mentioned that, most significantly for fans, probably, is that they will be light and dark worlds, which is, I'm not sure how that's going to tie in story-wise, and we don't really know, like, the mechanism.
You're telling me that the 3DS sequel to Link to the Past is going to have light and dark worlds, similar to Link to the Past.
Except if you think about what happened at the end of A Link to the Past, the dark world turned back into the golden world, right?
It's been a long time since I played it, but I would assume also, because it's a sequel to Link in the Past, and that was one of the best parts of it, Light and Dark World, they'll find a way. They'll find
a
reason.
They'll be like, oh, the new enemy corrupted it again.
And you better be like a little rabbit piggy thing. I can't remember.
At least
rabbit,
initially,
right?
Before you get the moon pearl or whatever.
I mean,
I love that game.
It's a great game.
I mean, I hate all Zelda games that aren't Zelda 2.
Really?
No, that's the meme. That's the meme. I like Zelda.
One other little thing that was revealed in this CNET interview is that the Phantom Ganon encounter from the Forest Temple in Ocarina of Time is what inspired the kind of mural, what we call mural Link. They're referring to it as hieroglyph.
Is it an intramural Link?
Funny enough, actually, the Phantom Ganon was actually one of my favorite fights in Ocarina of Time.
That was a great fight.
That was a really great fight.
It was actually my favorite fight, unlike Bongo Bongo.
I was just going to say, you didn't like Bongo Bongo?
Bongo Bongo was a bitch.
Bongo Bongo, no, seriously, that fucker can... I'm not going to talk about it because, you know...
I'm not joking, and Jason can corroborate this. Bongo Bongo was by far my favorite experience and moment in all of Ocarina of Time.
Probably because you saw
Somehow
me throw my
I'm
controller.
Not surprised, just knowing you. You're always so contrary with everything.
No, I just love, like, I loved archery in that game. I loved the bow and arrow. Love, love, loved it. And I loved that there was a boss that required you to do it well and fast. I was into that.
He was. It was one of his favorite bosses. Actually, when we played the game, we were playing it like side by side on dual TVs because
that's what you did.
Exactly. And, like, he finished Bongo Bongo, and I was still doing fighting him. He's like, well, you're not done yet? And I threw my controller at him.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty epic. God, what show did we watch while we were doing that? Street Smarts?
I don't even remember.
It was Street Smarts.
I think so.
Oh, man. All right, well, next up on the list. By the way, if we have any Street Smarts fans out there, feel free to tweet at us your memories of the show, hashtag Street Smarts.
Is that show still on?
I doubt it. So, Zone of the Enders PS3 has been patched. Well, is going to be patched. You may recall the Zone of Enders HD collection hit some number of months ago. There was a lot of complaints about how the game ran from a technical standpoint. Lots of frame drops, sort of some graphical effects that were just completely missing from the original PS2 version. I guess Konami has sort of seen it in their grand vision to grace us with a patch fixing these issues. And that's cool, but it's really not the important part of this news story. Unfortunately, during the podcast wherein
Kojima-san
had to swallow.
TMI!
Where Kojima-san was talking about this, he also unfortunately revealed that the Enders project, the planned sequel to the franchise that they were currently working on, has been put on hold.
That's a bit disappointing.
Seawolf Jason, how do you feel about the shelving of a sequel to Zone of Enders? I seem to recall you liking that game.
Yeah, no, I did. I liked it. I mean, it's sad. I mean, it happens.
Would you have bought it if it came out?
Maybe.
There was some indication that it was going to be a 3DS game.
No, yeah. I mean, it really all depends. We could get into this later, but literally my time has dwindled, so my ability to game has also dwindled. So I kind of have to pick and choose what I play.
I see. Well, that makes sense.
I just have to say that I want Kojima-san to be on our podcast.
Yeah, I feel like that's never going to happen, but I guess don't stop believing.
Hashtag don't stop believing.
Hashtag hold on to that feeling.
Hashtag last update of the week. Sound Shapes, the rhythm indie darling that we talk about here a lot in the Game Buoy Studios, is getting another batch of DLC next week. In North America, also next week in Europe. Awesome. This DLC is going to be two sound packs. One is 1980s themed, and one is dubstep themed. Seawolf Jason, have you seen Sound Shapes yet?
I have not seen it in person. I've heard about it.
Oh, it's so good.
My main thing is, as you may know, I'm very anti-rhythm games. I just have no rhythm, so yeah. I can't play them.
I've played Rock Band with you. I know.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I think they're pretty. And actually, yeah, I've heard a lot about it, and I've heard good things about it, but, yeah.
Yeah. I will probably run that for you a little bit here after the show tonight, because it's really quite a special game. And Beck did some exclusive music for it.
Oh, that's cool. So
and
good.
Beck. So, and with that, I think we are done with our follow-ups. It is time for...
News. Oh my god, news.
And we're back. Alright, so let's talk a little bit about the news of the week. First up on the list, we have the next Xbox is going to be officially revealed on May 21st. So, like, 2 weeks from now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I am excited as crap for this. What do you guys think?
I'm glad that we're going to be finding out. I'm a little bit less... I mean, I guess I can't say that I'm looking forward to it less, because we don't know if any of those rumors about the always-on and stuff are true. But, yeah, it'll be good to finally clear the air.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there.
I'll wait for to see it. I mean, my thing is I won't get into it, but I have a personal experience, negative experience with Microsoft, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
Kind of like my personal negative experience with Sony that I had to bury the hatchet with.
The one that used to make you be a complete bitter Betty for many years.
Yeah. I'm probably going to bite the bullet and buy the next Xbox.
Yeah, well, you're you. So.
I would probably own all three as well.
I'll probably...
Wii U, obviously, I don't know.
I'll probably buy one, but it's like with PS4, I'm definitely day one. For Xbox, I might wait.
Yeah, I might wait for the
We'll just have to see what is
I'm
revealed.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's the problem. I think I'll have to see what's revealed at Xbox Reveal. which I assume is what the title is. This is what everyone's referring to it as. Xbox reveal.
Xbox reveal.
Because I wasn't really looking, I wasn't really expecting much out of PS4, and then after Sony meeting,
bam, bitches!
Like, yeah, it was like Alexis Mateo was like, bam, bitches. Yeah, so we'll have to see. And we'll be talking to you about it on Game Boom.
And you obviously wanted to talk about Illumaroom for a moment?
Illumaroom looks awesome. Anyone who doesn't think it looks awesome, they're just haters, or they don't have the nice room setup. I have a nice setup for it.
You do.
So,
you will have a legit Illumaroom.
Yeah, you would have a good Illumaroom.
So, I'm like, hells yeah.
Oh, I'm definitely looking forward to Illumaroom, but, I mean, is it really looking like that might be going live with Nextbox?
You know, we keep seeing the proof of concept video pop up. I don't really know what I think yet about the viability of this as real tech to be included with the platform. But if they can manage it, because, you know, I was saying a lot of these same things about the Kinect, and that works better than I thought it was going to.
True.
If Microsoft has this shit figured out, then that might be a deal maker. I was going to say a deal breaker, but it would be a deal maker.
It's the opposite. Yeah, it's a deal maker. All right, well, moving on. We also had news at Nintendo's financial results meeting for the year that while Nintendo has returned to profitability, they still missed their sales forecasts by 50%.
Which is disappointing, but I feel like people are making a lot bigger deal out of this than it really is. I mean, you know, yeah, that's missing a forecast, but I think people interpret it as, oh, it's gloom and doom for Nintendo. It's like, weren't we talking at one point, I don't know if it was on air or just casually talking, that Nintendo has enough money that even if they, like, just totally had a bunch of duds, that they could still last for, like, at least a decade?
Yeah, they have something like billions of dollars saved up. It's generally referred to in the gaming community as the Great Nintendo War Chest.
My thing about Nintendo is this. I love the Wii U. I think it might have a slow start because of some of the... But I think it's more of a haters gonna hate because simple as that, E3's gonna come out, Smash Brothers, Mario,
exactly.
Mario Kart, Zelda, it's gonna print money after that.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. I guessed it last week on Orange Lounge Radio. Hopefully all of our listeners have listened to that, but probably one or two haven't. So let me just say what I said there. We know for fact that at E3 this year, Nintendo is going to have Smash Brawl, a new Smash Brothers game. Mario U, which is the successor to Galaxy, not like a new Super Mario Brothers, but like a straight up new 3D Mario game. And also Mario Kart 8.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, like, three of the most popular games ever from last console generation. You know, Smash Brothers and Kart in particular. So, I don't really understand this negativity. And Nintendo has said that they are dead set on getting Mario U and Mario Kart 8 out this year.
Yep.
And you look at, you know, they have Pikmin coming out for sure in August. We have Wonderful 101 coming out this summer. We have Game & Wario coming out in June. This slate of games is about to get real crazy. We have Wind Waker HD.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, they were talking about that they wanted to spread out their big titles a little bit. And so, I mean, like, maybe they expected a little more, but I mean, this has been their strategy, so no one should really be surprised.
Same thing as the 3DS.
Yeah,
it came out.
With the 3DS.
It was a little slow. They made a few adjustments, got some real killer software out, and now it's doing really, really great numbers, especially in Japan, but also in the US. Like, I appreciate that there's this weird meme among the gaming community that's like, oh, the 3DS is still really slow in the US, but
like, no,
it's actually not.
Huge.
It's still doing pretty all right.
Beats the Vita.
Say that a little louder. I want to make sure the mic got it.
Still beats the Vita.
To which I say, what doesn't?
What doesn't, exactly.
And that's the perfect note to move on from. Let's see, I have an entry here that basically just says what we were just going to say, so I'm going to skip it for those of you that are looking at our show roll notes, which is none of you because you don't have access to them. But we have news at this same investors meeting, or possibly a day or two earlier, that Satoru Iwata-san is going to be assuming the Nintendo of America CEO role.
And a lot of people were like, oh no, what's going to happen to Reggie?
I don't give a fuck about Reggie. But he's not going nowhere.
No, no. I believe I heard that he's the COO.
That is correct.
I like Reggie, so.
I think that Reggie is fine. I like Iwata-san a lot. It's clear that Iwata-san cares a lot about game design, and that's important to me.
No, that's true.
I don't think Reggie really cares about games. He just really wants Nintendo to be, like, extreme and popular!
Which is also good. I really like where, just kind of the way that Nintendo interacts with its user base since Iwata took the head.
Oh, yeah, I think it was amazing with Nintendo Directs and everything.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because that ties into our next bullet point, which is also our last about Nintendo, for those of you haters out there. Nintendo has announced that they won't be hosting a keynote event at E3 this year. Instead, they're going to opt for small but focused hands-on events at the actual convention, and relying on direct communication to their user base for their announcements.
Smaller, more frequent patches.
I think this is a great idea, personally. One, for a lot of reasons. We have Nintendo Directs,
exactly.
Which is directly to the consumer, which is us. E3, even though we get to see the big thing, really what most people want to know is they want to know how these games play. They want to see clips of people playing Mario Kart.
Exactly.
They want to see clips of playing the new Mario game. Nintendo could say, oh, here's a video and we're making it, but we all know you're making it. We just want to see it being played.
Yeah, you know, especially like compared to E3, say 15 years ago, when the internet news scene was, I mean, like gaming news scene was not nearly what it is now. I mean, you know, IGN and stuff was around then, but you know, you think of how something at E3, you're gonna find out about it like at the most a day later or like a couple days later if it's not as pressing of a news update. So, I mean, you know, what's the point of having a big streamed keynote when exactly like Seawolf Jason is saying, you know, we want to see these games in action. So,
yeah, I have never really felt like the E3 format was particularly suited to Nintendo's focus on actual games. You know, and I don't really mean to shade anyone, but now I'm going to shade some people. You look at E3's conference, you look at Sony's E3 conference or Microsoft's E3 conference, and it's really more about what celebrities can we get to come out on stage and talk about voice acting in our game while showing a clip roll of the CG.
I mean, I can't help but wonder if after this year, now that, because I'm sure that Sony and Microsoft have been planning their E3 keynotes for a while. And now that Nintendo
just cut me off midpoint for a long tangent.
Nintendo has dropped this bomb now. I can't help but wonder. We had Microsoft coming up with the Xbox reveal. We had Sony with the Sony meeting. I can't help but wonder if we're going to start seeing a trend like that. And, you know, maybe at E3 2014, maybe no keynotes.
I know you're midstream. Do you want to finish what you were going to say?
I do.
Okay,
thank
go
you.
Ahead, and then I will say.
You know, so Nintendo's focus is more on showing actual games, talking about game design. This comes out while talking about Nintendo Land. And I appreciate that maybe a lot of people out there didn't think Nintendo Land was anything special. I disagree with you. I think Nintendo Land's very, very special.
They're just haters.
But I don't think it can be argued, because this is a fact. Nintendo's discussion of Nintendo Land at E3, when they announced it, was about the game design philosophies that went into each minigame. And I am a gamer because I like games, not because I care about who did your CGI, not because I care about which starlet is doing the voice of your heroine. I want the games. And for me, Nintendo is the one who's going to come out here and just, they're like, nope, this production is not a great match for us. We're just going to show you direct. This is our games. And I think that's a great thing. I don't think that the E3 keynote format suited Nintendo. And I can tie this into what Slagkick just said. I do think that Sony and Microsoft, since they're both more major electronics producers and manufacturers, will probably still have something to say at shows like E3. They'll still have Kinect add-ons and Wonder Books to show. So I don't know that I really see them necessarily scaling back, But they have done sort of more direct style communication with their audiences. In particular, there's been two Vita Heaven events that Sony has done that basically just rip off.
Does that mean the Vita died?
That basically just... That's funny. That basically just rip off the Nintendo Direct style. So, I typically call it Vita Hades, but, you know. Now, for you, Seawolf Jason, thank you for letting me go.
No, you're welcome. I just want to go on to E3 real quick. History of E3, not going to be too long, but they were allowed, actually, civilians in E3, and we went to E3, actually. And
we did, back in 06, maybe?
It was great. It was, and then they started doing press only again.
Yeah.
And, well, the fact is, I think a lot of people, they're doing these, a lot of these direct broadcasts, because it goes directly to the consumer. We don't have to pay for an E3 broadcast
exactly.
or watch it on TV or check yeah. up our local news bulletins for the information. It's directly to
yeah,
us.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that basically E3, unless they, again, open up to the public, they might soon find themselves out of the
yeah.
conference.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that.
It's a retailer and business event, and it's probably for the better that E3 gets back to being that, and we just get to talk about games.
Yeah, we kind of touched on that with our first annual E3 blowout last year.
First annual E3 blowout!
Yeah, because, you know, so anyways, we should move on from this, but that's a good point.
Yeah, I think we could probably just talk about game design and Nintendo and communication philosophies for a long time, and we still have a lot of show to go. So, mini discussion happened out of nowhere. Next up, we have Corpse Party continuing. This is, of course, the somewhat popular new-ish JRPG series on the PSP. Unfortunately, it's actually a really great game. It's basically like an 8-bit style horror JRPG.
Oh, that
sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's rad as hell. I say 8-bit, but maybe like 16-bit. But that era of JRPG and like horror
great.
With like blood and zombies and scary stuff.
In fact, the Vita entry is going to be called Corpse Party Blood Drive.
Yes, the new game is Corpse Party Blood Drive, and it's going to continue the story from Chapter 8 of Corpse Party Book of Shadows. That chapter was itself called Blood Drive. Please look forward to it.
I want to take this next one.
I knew you would, girl.
Those of you listening in jolly old England or anywhere else in the UK, we like all our UK listeners, not just the British, you will be treated to a shocking pink 3DS XL.
And I hate you for it, because I would like that even more than that rad Luigi Couture 3DS.
What about the Animal Crossing Couture one?
I ain't here for that. No, I kind of am.
Watch, that's probably going to be the one you pick up.
Anyway, go forward.
That's it.
Oh, okay.
It's next month, UK, shocking pink 3DS XL.
Delightful.
Look forward to it.
Something that I'm really looking forward to, the PC release of Leisure Suit Larry Reloaded is stated for June.
You nasty.
I love them. I mean, there was King Quest with penises, so.
Yeah, I mean.
I don't think we can say anything.
With a description like that, that really says it
that
all.
That sums it up.
Let's see. Next up, we have Hakuoki, Memories of the Shinsengumi, coming to the 3DS in America. This is exciting because, as you may be aware, this is the sort of life simulator / dating sim / story game based on sort of making Bishonen Men out of the Shinsengumi. The squadron or troop. I don't really know how to say
it. I automatically take it to a Rurouni Kenshin place.
I knew you would. So that's pretty funny. I don't actually have a lot to say about that, except I'm going to buy it. I really like when these weird Japanese games come out in English, so I'm here for that.
I have had a recent massive interest in getting into the dating sort of sim franchise, and I'll explain why later.
You'll be explaining why in about 40 seconds. First,
that's not why, but I see why you're saying
that. Oh, okay. Okay, but first, there is going to be a new Kunio-kun game hitting the 3DS in August.
Kunio-kun!
You're probably familiar with the Kunio-kun games via their US releases, Renegade, Super Dodgeball, River City Ransom.
Yeah. So when you hear it like that, you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of exciting news.
Yep. In Japan, August 8th, hot-blooded tough guy Kunio Fighting Concerto will be coming out. Members from the original team are supervising the game, which will have a brand new story and also has a lot of, like, 8-bit sprite love in the style of what's popular now. Yeah. I thought you'd be, in particular, would be excited about that.
No, yeah. See, it's funny because when you hear Kunio-kun, you're like, so what? But then you're like, oh, shit, River City Ransom.
Yeah, right? So this is what I thought Slagkick would be excited about for his dating sim trip.
No.
But you may recall, we didn't really talk about it here on the show, because by the time we learned about it, it had been removed from the App Store. But there was a really just completely bizarre dating sim game for the iPhone called Boyfriend Maker. And this is, it's basically just this really hilarious and creepy,
and
like,
really poorly
coded Bishonen man whom you get, like, a chat prompt with, and then it, like, machine responds to you based on other people's responses. So you'll end up saying something like, what do you think about abortions? And then he will say in, like, leet speak, like, abortions are great, kill all babies.
That actually happened to Jeremy from the Koopa Club podcast.
I wish I could show our listeners the look on Seawolf Jason's face right now. Can you talk?
I can talk, but I mean,
do you want to know what I said? What I said to my boyfriend, and I've since deleted it just because I was, like, so bored with it. But I asked my boyfriend, "Are you gay?" Like in like internet speak. And he said, "Oh yes, I love dicks." Then he said something about, like, "Oh, I'm hungry. Do you want to have dinner?" And then I said something like penis. And he's like, "Ew."
Apparently he didn't like dicks that much.
Right?
Not to eat them for dinner.
That is a poor life choice. Moving on, we have news of not one, but two movies based on Sony games. First up is Ratchet & Clank, which will actually be probably kind of cool. It's going to be like a CGI motion picture, going to be treated kind of like a real game. That's actually like a real movie. That's actually kind of cool.
Done,
I like Ratchet and Clank.
If done right, I can imagine it being a great, great movie. At least enjoyable.
Yeah. Do you know what's not going to be great?
Yeah, I can see the clip notes right here.
The direct-to-DVD Heavenly Sword
movie. Is it
movie.
Really direct-to-DVD?
That's what I had heard, yeah.
Oh.
I have no idea why. I don't get it.
Like, why would you make that? Like, that seems like a huge waste of money, right?
It does. I mean, like, they can't expect a major make profit on that.
Right? Like, maybe, I thought after how bad that first game turned out to be, and maybe not bad, but mediocre, like, maybe they're trying to, like, rehab the series and, like, give it credit,
yeah.
But making a direct-to-DVD movie is not the way to do that. Making a good game is the way to do that.
Yep.
Or just get rid of the franchise in general.
Yeah, right? Like, that was Ninja Theory, the guys behind DMC Devil May Cry, the reboot.
Mm-hmm.
They still don't really know how to make a game. It's kind of sad.
No. Yeah, I mean, I agree.
Frown.
I actually, as I've spoken here on the show, DMC Devil May Cry was better than I was expecting. But when you're expecting to get shot in the head, getting punched in the chest feels pretty good.
I was about to say, you were expecting like a pile of dog crap and you got maybe like a burnt cookie. You're like, yay!
I don't really like burnt cookies, but it's better than dog crap.
Exactly.
Moving on, we have news that in Japan, the Distant Worlds Final Fantasy Music Concert is going to be released on Blu-ray. This is, of course, of interest to anyone listening to this podcast. Well, not anyone, but the people in the U.S. Because the U.S. and Japan share the same Blu-ray region,
yep.
This will be available for easy importing.
I'm glad for that.
Yeah, I'll definitely be ordering that. We also have, and I'm actually really excited to play this game myself a little bit down the line, news of Green Heart Games, creator of Game Dev Tycoon. So this is actually a really funny story. Have either of you heard this story?
Yes.
Are you talking about
the piracy?
Yes.
Okay, so basically, this game, you make a game studio. It's not entirely dissimilar to the game dev story Kairosoft game for iOS, but it's a little more fleshed out, more of a sim. But they made it so that if you pirated this game, your in-game dev studio that you're simulating will eventually be crippled by piracy and forced to close. I think that that is probably the best possible anti-piracy method I've ever heard, and yeah. I salute them.
Unfortunately, when they blogged about it on their site, like, it was within the first day or so of it launching, I think, but very few people had actually bought it. So I'm hoping that all of this coverage will bring in a lot of support for this game, and so that they can actually turn a profit on it.
Yeah, it was like 6% actually legally bought the game.
Yeah,
well, yeah, that was really sad. I'm going to as soon as it's on Steam. I kind of really don't like buying games from just random people, like giving out my credit card number. So as soon as it's on Steam, I'm there. I voted for it on Greenlight, and I suggest you all do too.
I agree with you. I mean, especially, yeah, for indie developers, you can get on Greenlight. Steam is the way to go.
My thing is less about giving out my credit card and more about I want to know that if I enter my by entering a serial number in Steam, I know that I'll have it, like, pretty much forever, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, presumably, you would probably have, like, a download link in your email forever from these guys.
Yeah,
I hope. That's how some studios do it. Quite related, in fact, Publisher Dream will be available in Europe this week and in the U.S. next week via DSiWare, which is also accessible on the 3DS. And this is basically another game development sim. Although the focus on this is a Japanese-made game, it looks like, is to express to gamers how fun but simultaneously stressful game development can be. Please look forward to it. I am, and I love buying stuff on DSi/3DS, so I'll totally buy this. Like, it's not even a question. It doesn't even have to be very good. Like, I'm not gonna lie. I'd buy Chuck Rock on Virtual Console.
I can see you enjoying the
horrible game.
No, I would.
I can see you enjoying
the
stressful
tap
element.
To make him jump.
What were you saying?
I can see you enjoying the stressful element of Publisher Dream.
Yeah, true facts. I probably would.
You'd probably get, like, really pissed at it, but then you'd be like, no, but it's super great, but I'm really mad at it right now.
Yeah, that would definitely happen.
That will happen. You'll probably talk about it in a couple weeks on What's Up.
Almost certainly. Let's see. I skipped this news, so I'm going to get to it right now. Hideki Kamiya-san from Platinum Games, whom we talk about pretty much all the damn time, stated that he feels that if a game is short but very good, that gamers should be happy with that game because a good experience is better than an artificially inflated one. Within minutes, the entire internet was talking about how this must be a sign that Wonderful 101 must be a short game, and he's doing, like, advanced, like, preparation and, like, defense of the game. And basically, all of the Platinum Games people were like, y'all are making things up. Like, we literally did not say that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the whole news story there. Any thoughts?
Honestly, if Kamiya-san or anyone at Platinum wanted to make a short game, they would have design reasons for it. So,
personally, when I'm split on the fence when it comes to this, because as I mentioned, I don't have much gaming time, so a shorter experience would be great. But at the same time, games nowadays, they cost like $60, and you know, it all depends how much I'm willing to pay for that experience. And,
that's true.
You know, if they're, you know, maybe nowadays games can have, like, movies in the back at, like, average game time.
Yeah, that honestly, would actually not be awful.
I agree. And
communicating
honestly,
that would probably go a long way to solving these
woes. I think we really need to see more flexible pricing. But, you know, like you said, Seawolf Jason, it's all about making money, and they know people will pay $50, $60 for games.
Yeah, I do think the rigidity of the current pricing model really damages the industry, because you see people, when a game comes out at a budget price, we saw this with Anarchy Reigns, for example.
Yep, I was thinking about that myself.
A lot of people were not willing to look at the game for what it is. They just automatically thought, oh, this is cheap, it must be crap. It's
when
really
in fact
sad.
It was really good.
Yeah, it was a great game. Anarchy Reigns, made by Platinum Games. Like, how could you not be there for that?
Deathball, or what was that mode called? Was it Deathball?
Yeah, whatever it was called, I really liked playing it.
It was really fun.
Seawolf Jason is like, can y'all stop now, though?
No, I just never played the game, so whatever. I
mean, we need to fix that.
I thought you played Anarchy Reigns with us.
Have I?
No. In other news, Sonic the Hedgehog's latest arcade game requires players to run on treadmills in order to make their player avatar move.
I heard about this. I want to play it so bad.
I bet. I wonder, you know, did you see that Milpitas Golf Land is no longer a proper arcade? It's just a laser tag room now.
I heard about that, actually.
Yeah, I was just going to say we should go over there and play it, but now we won't get to. So because of that, we won't be able to give you Game Buoy's official opinion on Sonic Athletics is the name of this game.
There's actually a button where you can do a hurdle jump where you jump.
That is awesome, although I wish you rather just had to jump like the old Nintendo Pro Pad games.
That would be awesome, but probably would be too expensive on the treadmills. Probably.
I bet that if we went and played it, you'd make me... You'd, like, claim Sonic, someone else would get Knuckles, and I'd be stuck with Amy Rose.
No, you'd be Big the Cat.
Oh my god, I would intentionally, like, not run. I'd be like, ooh.
I would love anyway. play this game against you guys, because it's probably one of the games I would actually win.
Rude and
so hateful. We'll have to see if any arcades in the Greater Bay Area have them.
And to be fair, I'm looking over the character roster now, and Big the Cat is not in it.
Ooh. I was kind of.
You can be
was.
Silver.
I can't even react to that. Just move on.
So Nintendo has started selling quote-unquote authentic refurbished DSi and 3DS systems with the standard Nintendo warranty at prices $10 below what GameStop sells the same.
Interesting.
So you can, starting right this very moment, load up, you know, Nintendo's online official online store and score a Midnight Purple 3DS for $130 with Nintendo's standard warranty and everything.
I think it's great. I think more companies should be able to do this, and that will also kick out that second market that they're complaining so much about.
Yep, I absolutely agree.
Yeah, let's see. Would I rather get a 3DS from Nintendo or from GameStop? Let me think about that.
Yep. Nintendo says that these authentic refurbished units are fully functional, but may occasionally feature quote-unquote minor blemishes. I'm the kind of guy that's not a deal breaker. I don't really mind at all, as long as the screen is okay, and I don't think they'd be selling 3DSs
right.
with jacked up screens, so I think it'd probably be alright.
It's just a little dent.
Yeah, that's not the kind of thing I really worry too much about. Let's see. In news that makes me want to murder people, Square Enix has announced a new Final Fantasy Tactics game. Which, of course, sounds good so far, until you realize that Final Fantasy Tactics S is actually a social game.
Well, the S
which
stands
is what
social.
The S stands for. I have so little to say about this because I am in legitimate emotional turmoil over it.
Do you know how much it's probably going to cost?
$50.
$50? That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Oh, I was going to say, actually, when I heard about the news, I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, kind of intrigued, and then, yeah, the price point idea concept.
Now, obviously,
you know?
We here on Game Buoy aren't against iOS Square Enix games, but Captain Spike is a very, very dedicated tactics fan, so it kind of hits you right in the cojones.
Yeah, it really does. It's rather very unpleasant. Slidekick, if you could take this next one for me.
It's looking like an Eternal Darkness sequel might actually be happening. I never played the original Eternal Darkness, so I unfortunately can't say too much about that, but I know that it was a very popular and beloved game by many.
Yeah. It's a great game. And really, the thrust of this story is basically that, you know, we knew that Dennis Dyack's studio, Silicon Knights, was working on pre-production for a Eternal Darkness spiritual sequel, which is what this appears to be. Dyack has confirmed that he's involved. But basically, they're going to be launching a Kickstarter for it next week.
Oh, nice.
Because, essentially, they can't get any major publishers to fund this game for them because they are awful flops. We've talked about this on the show.
Yes, I was just thinking about that.
They have made, several really poor business choices over the last decade. Too Human, that really bad X-Men game that did really bad. They had their failed lawsuit against Epic over the Unreal Engine.
Right.
And so what this really comes down to me is this, and I don't normally gang up on people, and I feel really bad saying this, but I'm going to tell you all out there in Radioland right now, I believe it's in your best interest to pretend that this Kickstarter doesn't exist and do not give these people your money. Of course, I'd love to hear from Slagkick or Seawolf Jason if you think I'm being too harsh. But frankly, I think that these folks have shown us that they cannot manage their money, and I don't think crowdsourcing is going to fix those problems.
I was actually exactly thinking about the... Because we were talking about that specifically on... I don't remember. It must have been Read of the Week when we read articles before Smash or Trash. But that was our good article. Or it might have even been a Waltaku, but like a good Waltaku, or I don't know. But we talked about the article in any regard.
If this Kickstarter succeeds, I think it'll create a bad business model where a lot of more higher produced, like known publishers will just say, hey, we don't have the people pay for it, and we don't have to pay for it ourselves. I just think it's going to be a bad business model, and I agree. I think they've shown that they can't make a game and that we shouldn't give them their money.
Okay, I'm really glad we're on the same page here, because I really do strongly feel like all artists should have the right to ask for support, and I think that sort of producing art for money, that's an important thing. It's just, I can't get behind a studio that has so clearly mismanaged money so many times asking for people to fund them directly.
This would be kind of like Nickelback asking for a Kickstarter for their next record.
I don't think that holds because, I mean, as shitty as they are, at least Nickelback puts out records.
I was just talking about the quality of Silicon Knights games in general, the money management.
Well, they made the original Eternal Darkness, and that's like a, 9 out of 10 game for most people.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, and I personally, I kind
I
of like
to Nickelback.
Oh, okay. I would say it would be more like... My Bloody Valentine asking for a Kickstarter for an album 10 years ago and then not putting out a record until now.
Yeah.
And then charging for it again.
All right.
Yeah. So...
Here's some kind of controversial news.
I really need you to take this one. I can't really talk about this very much, but I think it's important for us to cover it. If you two can handle this.
So... Speaking of Scribblenauts, like we kind of alluded to earlier, two meme creators, specifically the creator of Nyan Cat and the creator of the Keyboard Cat meme, are going to be suing the Scribblenauts. I'm sorry, I can't off the top of my head think of the specific studio that...
Fifth Cell.
Oh, duh.
I love that I have a document here, like a cheat sheet, and you don't, and you still had it.
It's Scribblenaut, so.
I was mixing up, different stuff, sorry. I should have known that. So they're suing Fifth Cell. And, because, if you enter in Nyan Cat or Keyboard Cat, a little sprite of them will pop up and do whatever. Have you ever actually done that?
Yes, actually, but besides the point, I actually have a lot to say about this, but I'll try to keep it short.
I encourage you, since I really would be better not commenting on this, I would really encourage you to say as much as you have to say on it.
So originally when I first saw this article, I was like, that's ridiculous, because it's like, what? It's everywhere out there, and everyone can use it. And there's all these non-cats and keyboard cats things. Keyboard Cat was in another ad with, a phone and stuff. And so it's like...
Non-cat was in a commercial.
Yeah, so it's like that. Too. But then I think it was the non-cat mater... I think it was his Twitter or his blog or something, he actually wrote this thing that was actually really poignant and made a lot of sense. He was saying the reason why he's doing this is because that they didn't ask permission, and that these big companies like Warner Brothers Entertainment, we're not talking about this cell, we're talking about big boy Warner Brothers Entertainment, who could have easily asked for permission, easily just send a note, hey, can we do this? Didn't even bother, and felt that they can just use this and not ask for permission. And it creates a poor standard. And, like, I bet you if they just asked, he would have said, of course. And actually, he mentioned that he probably would, but it was the fact that they didn't ask, they just felt they could use it, and without even asking.
Yeah, and I mean, I definitely understand that, and I understand that, you know, the people behind these memes are just, you know, regular people like you and I, maybe getting a little extra income from, like, Neon Cat, Keyboard Cat, merchandise, or whatever. The thing that I think is interesting, and I don't mean this personally against the individuals behind these memes, is that it just sets a really, it might set an interesting precedent for memes, because...
Well, you know, let me interject here, and I'm, because you're going to be able to just continue what you're saying and answer the question I'm about to ask. I want to pose a three-pronged question to both of you. That is, first, how do you feel that this... Let's say, for example, that this ruling ends up going in favor of Neon Cat and Keyboard Cat's alleged owners. Do you feel that will put games like Guacamelee in danger? Because that game has a lot of memes present as well. A lot of Grumpy Cat, a lot of just other really popular memes are referenced in that game. Second off, do you feel like the plaintiffs in this case aren't somewhat sort of posing this as like a David and Goliath, little guy versus the big guy thing? And then third, I actually ended up just folding that into another question, so this is only a two-prong question.
Yes to both.
That's okay, not even but an answer. That wasn't a yes or no question.
No, you know what? I'll go ahead and answer that. Okay, if they succeed, and you're right, I think that could be a devastating standard, because you're right, there's a lot of quirky games with a lot of these internet memes, and they bring light to it, and it's like, huh. But, you know, you think about this lawsuit, and Scribblenauts had Keyboard Cat in, like, in its first generation, so it's like, it's a long time coming, you know?
Yeah, why now
is kind of a question. But I think it's right. It's more of a publicity stunt, or it's like, it's David versus Goliath. And I think that's the point they're trying to make. They're saying, like, you should respect us. And I think if big companies kind of respect, like, the small independent makers, it helps. But they think they can get away with things. And I think it's just their idea of trying to prevent that from happening. But I do think that might create a devastating standard.
Well said. Now, the point I actually want to make is, and I'm not too familiar with the intellectual property personally of Neon Cat, Keyboard Cat, are they trademarked, copyrighted, like, by law?
Well, I mean, in terms of common law, once they put these things out on the internet with their names on it and became widely recognized as their names being attached to it, they could effectively claim a copyright. The branch of law in which I work is not specifically related to intellectual property law. But that is my understanding of those laws.
Yeah, I just wonder how this is going to affect memes and copyright issues.
Well, that's exactly why I was asking the setting a standard issue. And while I had approached it specifically for other games, because we're a games podcast, I do assume it would also affect sitcoms that might make a reference without clearing it through legal or what have you.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think it will create a devastating standard, but I think in general... It's just one of those things that, you know, as a little person, you gotta root for the little guy. That's just how I feel. Even though I don't think this is gonna be the right step in the right direction.
Interesting, interesting. And Slykick, your final thoughts on this?
I'm honestly kind of over internet memes anyway, so if this meant...
Liar. Go ahead.
If this meant that... If this had an impact kind of on the development and the proliferation of memes, you know, I honestly, you know, I think the thing that would be the most sad is that if, like, Guacamelee had to be pulled or got sued
Well, that's why I dropped that name in particular, because I'm a huge fan of that game, and it really does a lot of references to memes, and I would hate to see it in any danger.
But honestly, like, if this meant, like, that Advice Animals got copyrighted, and then everyone else just got in such a big fight that they're just like, ugh, they just basically killed memes, I wouldn't care.
I just have a random question. In Guacamelee credits, do they actually, like...
I haven't finished the game, so I don't know.
Because they might even thank the people, because you never
know. Oh, and in that case, maybe they have communicated with them, and then it's all legit, maybe.
Because in Scribblenauts, that they don't really communicate.
I'd be interested, because we're going to move on in a minute.
Okay,
but,
yeah. No, go
ahead. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted one last thing. I wonder if the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's what they're called, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if they are have said anything or gotten involved, because we mentioned them before, they do some cool stuff. So I wonder if they are involved with this somehow. But anyway, that was just something.
So next up, and nearing our discussion topic, finally, we have two DLC reveals for the recently released Injustice: Gods Among Us. You may recall I spoke last week a little bit about playing this game. I really like it and am pretty excited about its existence. In any event, the DLC that has been announced so far are Lobo, which is, of course, DC's answer to Wolverine, more or less, and Batgirl.
I feel like more people will be excited about Batgirl. I'm not a DC person, so...
I'm excited that more characters are in the game, because I love the game, also. They wouldn't be the characters I would have chosen, but I can understand Lobo, because a lot of people love Lobo.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's an interesting character, in general. Batgirl, don't get me wrong, like, it's great, but there's a lot of complaint online and stuff about it being a lot of Batman fighters in the game.
Yeah. You know, I actually do agree. I think that the Batman franchise is overrepresented in the game. But I am a huge Batgirl fan. I mean, most specifically of the Cassandra Cain incarnation of the character. But I feel like that is a pretty obvious alt skin for that character. And if there is a Cassandra Cain skin for her, then this is, like, I need it.
Well, I mean, the other thing about
now.
That is... I mean, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Like I said, I'm not a DC person, but isn't Batman basically, like, their biggest deal?
Batman, Superman.
Batman and Superman.
Well, I thought people cared more about Batman than
Superman. My thing is about this. There's a lot of Batman representation in the game, and maybe that's for a Batman fighter they might make, which I would buy.
Yeah, I would buy the crap out of that.
Think about Batman.
To answer your question, Slagkick, while I appreciate that Batman definitely gets the most play, I would definitely say that his franchise, in terms of multimedia, probably makes more money in terms of having more successful movies and more successful cartoons and stuff.
And games.
Yeah, I mean, there have been several somewhat popular Superman games.
Superman 64.
There's also been some of the worst game atrocities ever committed.
As a casual DC person...
But in the comics world... While Superman may not make the money that Batman makes, he certainly has as much and possibly more name recognition.
Yeah.
In fact, especially for older folks, I think that more older folks could tell you a lot more about Superman than they could about Batman. Even if you think about maybe like your mom could probably tell you the name of Batman or Superman's love interest, but she probably couldn't tell you the name of Batman's love interest.
That's true.
So it's, you know, there's different scales of things to look at here, but I definitely would say that they are both DC's sort of premier titles.
My main thing when it comes to the DLC, I mean, Batgirl, great, but, you know, where's my Booster Gold? Where's my even Martian Manhunter? You know, I'll be happy with Plastic Man, okay?
I am dying. Yeah, no, I would love for Booster Gold to be in the game.
I loved Booster Gold in DC Universe.
Yeah, well, he's funny.
He's kind of the Deadpool of
No, that's Deathstroke.
No, that's literally the Deadpool. I knew you were going to go there. But I mean, in terms of humor,
well, I thought you didn't know anything about DC.
I know a little bit about DC. I'm just not a big fan. I generally think that Marvel's better, but this is not a comics podcast.
No, it's not.
It should be.
But I mean, in terms of humor, Booster Gold, I would say, is probably that level of silliness.
Where are my Koopa Club kids at? We're supposed to do a comics podcast. Please look forward to it.
Are you really?
That's cool. I don't know how serious we are, but it's a thing that's been said. In any event, we have news out of Team Ninja that a new Dead or Alive 5 game is going to be headed to Xbox 360 and PS3. And it's worth mentioning that this was very specifically called a new Dead or Alive 5 game, as opposed to a new Dead or Alive. I am secretly hoping that maybe Dead or Alive 5 Extreme Beach Volleyball could be a thing.
I knew you were going to say that.
I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Dead or Alive games, so, I mean...
The teaser trailer for the game did, and this is actually really rather quite exciting, have a character from Ninja Gaiden featured in it. So if nothing else, at least maybe we're getting like a super release or something.
Who knows?
Super Dead or Alive 5.
Yay!
Gosh.
Super Dead or Alive 5 Turbo.
You would make the best reaction gifs, Seawolf Jason. Like, you just, you're like, you look like wretched. Like, you are not pleased about how long we're spending on Dead or Alive right now.
It doesn't
Honestly,
even deserve.
Dead or Alive.
It doesn't deserve the breath I'm wasting on it right now. Minus the movie, which was entertaining.
Yeah, I love that movie. That's probably my favorite, real secret favorite game movie.
Really?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so bad that it becomes incredibly, incredibly good.
That's a lot of game movies, though.
No, but not to this degree. Like, for example...
It's the point where it's campy.
Well, it's uber campy.
It's and supposed to be
it
campy.
Should be. It's tongue-in-cheek intentionally campy. And, like...
Oh, so it's kind of like that Will Ferrell Land of the
Have
Lost
you seen
movie?
It?
Yes, it isn't.
I haven't.
Oh, we're going to watch it tonight. Like, there's straight up a beach volleyball scene.
As there should be.
I just did gay flappy hands, listeners. Of course, I do that, like, 90% of the time. But...
And last, but certainly not least, we have news that King of Fighters and Fatal Fury and Art of Fighting characters are all going to be popping up in a social card game and slot machine game, respectively. These will probably never see release outside of Japan, but please be envious of it.
I am.
Yeah, me too. I love card games, and SNK Fighter-based card games are the best.
I want to go to Vegas and see if they have a slot machine.
Maybe they can be like Capcom and agree partnership.
The slot machine game is called Art of Fighting Rush. Oh, wait, that's the Art of Fighting game. The card game is the one that is King of Fighters Fatal Fury
style. Oh.
Yeah. It's not worth the drive to Vegas
no.
for Art of Fighting.
No, it's not.
But with that, it's time to talk about fighting games.
Fighting games.
So, I want to start off this discussion point here with a brief oral history of fighting games.
You said oral.
Girl, don't. I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about, you know, sort of the first 15 years of the genre. I'm going to try to keep it short and quick because I had hoped we would have made way more... We would have covered way more ground than we have so far tonight. So please bear with me as I talk to you a little bit about fighters. And Sega is widely regarded with having made the first video game to feature fist fighting. That was Heavyweight Champ in 1976.
When you said fist, I was worried you were going to say something else.
We're not talking about Custer's Revenge. And, you know, there was several games. This was a boxing game in black and white and stuff. And there were, for several years, quite a few boxing games. Like, clearly there was an interest in fighting, in games where combat and fist fighting was sort of the focus. But a few years later, Sega released, this was in 1983, the game Champion Boxing. Which is actually really most noteworthy for being the debut title of the legendary games designer Yu Suzuki. Of course, Suzuki-san would later go on to make such games as Shenmue or Hang-On. So, you know, that's obviously a really big deal. You know, Data East and Technos Japan, they created Karate Champ a few years later. Not even a few years, like the next year, which was sort of the first, like, one-on-one, real direct 2D fighting game. It featured a best of two a best of three format, like fighting games as we typically think of, and even featured training bonus stages, not entirely dissimilar to the sort of like test your might or beating up a car sort of mini game that you might expect to see in later fighting games.
I love beating up cars.
I am not talking about Pit Fighter. How dare you suggest that, Seawolf Jason? This is all well and good, but then we get to the game that most people really think of as, like, the first fighting game. I am talking about, of course, about Ye R. Kung Fu, which was a Konami game released in 1985, which featured, like, special moves, projectiles, and there's a pretty likely chance that if you're the kind of person who listens to Game Buoy, you probably have a compilation that has this game on it. I don't know that I would call it super good, but, you know, it wasn't awful. For a few years after that, there was a lot of clone games being made of Ye R. Kung Fu. I've never been able to pronounce that game. I've been trying for literally 20 years to pronounce that game correctly.
Because I guess that wouldn't really be that wouldn't be Japanese, so I would think Ye, but that would be Chinese.
Anyway,
it's Ye R. Kung Fu.
Yay, R. Kung Fu.
I like that. Lots of clones of Karate Champ. And you could make the argument that pretty much everything that happened in this space was basically clones. Resulting in Data East taking legal action against Epics over the computer game International Karate. All of these things, of course, ultimately culminated in Capcom's 1987 release, Street Fighter.
And it's just a little game. You haven't heard of it.
Yeah, oh, no, definitely.
Well, actually, to be fair, a lot of people probably haven't actually played Street Fighter.
That's probably more true really than you point. Would think.
I mean, I have, and I think you have.
Oh, definitely.
I didn't.
I was there, girl. And, you know, obviously, if you've never played Street Fighter, I highly recommend that you play the original. I believe it's available on the original Wii Virtual Console. The TurboGrafx PC Engine port was called Fighting Street.
Really?
So I would recommend you look into that. If it's not on there, of course, I apologize, and then you might need to go find your own way to play it, since there would then be no legal way to find it.
I didn't know that, but that's good. I might look it up on my Wii.
Excellent. Yeah, well, I mean, be good to do something with your Wii.
I know.
So, you know, the fighting scene was kind of quiet. I went to arcades a lot in this window. Like, this is really where I started growing up in arcades. And I remember so clearly the first time I saw Street Fighter II in an arcade game, in an arcade. It had just these beautiful sprites, just the size of the entire freaking screen, all super well animated, and just the control and how smooth everything moved. How reliable the jumps and diagonal direction actions and blocking worked. It was all just a dream. And I think that for most people, that's probably where the fighting genre started.
Yes.
You know, interestingly for me, I remember it the first time on SNES.
I almost said I don't think that's interesting, but that's not what I meant. That is interesting, but I don't think it's uncommon. I think that probably a lot of people in sort of our age group, that is to say people in their late 20s, early 30s, are probably more familiar with Street Fighter II as a Super Nintendo game.
I didn't have as
possibly
much access.
Possibly as a Genesis game.
Yeah, I didn't have as much access to arcades.
I mean, it was not the first time I played Street Fighter II, but definitely it was the most where I played Street Fighter II more often, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I pretty much grew up in an arcade, so that's, for me, that was, I would say I probably played nothing but that game for months.
And it was exciting when all of a sudden you could select the same character.
Oh yeah, well that was on the Super Nintendo, that's down R up L Y B, while the Capcom logo is sort of fading in the opening of the game. That was from memory, my friend. That is not in my notes.
Sometimes Captain Spike scares me with his knowledge.
So, You know, the funny thing about this, about Street Fighter II, and a lot of people don't really talk about this a lot, but that was the first fighting game that also had, like, combos and sort of chaining moves into one another, you know, auto-doubling and what have you. These were not intended design choices. These were actually due to a bug in the way that moves would resolve that would allow you to start one move before the first move had finished registering the hit.
Yeah, but it actually unintentionally started the genre and the idea of comboing.
Yeah, I mean, that I would say that that is literally, like, one of the primary pillars of game design in fighting.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely a mistake. It's just a mistake that...
It was a happy accident.
It's the happiest of accidents. That's like when you accidentally give birth, get pregnant and give birth, and then that baby becomes the president of the United States. Or, you know, Jesus. So
okay, that just got a little weird.
Baby's Jesus.
Are you seeing Obama's Jesus?
Now, something that a lot of people don't talk about a great deal is that Takashi Nishiyama, the creator of Street Fighter, the original game, actually worked with SNK to release the first release of the Fatal Fury series slightly before Street Fighter II. Fatal Fury, of course, was more of a story-based game, which obviously I find a bit questionable, but it was also very focused on, like, very strict tight timing windows for special moves, and had a really bizarre, like, dual-plane fighting system. Do you remember that at all, Seawolf Jason? You could jump into the background and sometimes jump through, like, rice paper screens or what have you?
No, I do actually remember that, and it's kind of ironic. Actually, ironic's not the word. I don't know what the word I'm looking for.
Well, it's ironic in the Alanis Morissette sense.
Well, just the fact that, you know, it's actually being brought into current games now, you know, environmental interaction.
Oh, yeah, specifically with games like Injustice, which has a environmental interact button.
Yes. But yeah, I remember that, and it was a little weird, because you weren't used to it at the time, and it was just kind of like, oh, this is interesting, because I played Street Fighter before. I actually found the game, so I was like, this is not Street Fighter. And that was my opinion of it.
This is not Street Fighter. You totally channeled the talking heads there. You're like, this is not my beautiful Street Fighter. And you may ask yourself, how did I get here? So, And, you know, after that, there was quite a few odds and ends and sort of little weird games. Sega did some experimentation using their that weird hologram arcade game stuff they were doing. I don't know if any of you guys remember that. But sort of the next real note is a couple years later. SNK put out The Art of Fighting and Samurai Showdown. Art of Fighting is, of course, probably best remembered in this day and age of being the direct influence for the creation of the Street Fighter character Dan Hibiki.
Oh, yes.
Dan Hibiki is basically Capcom's sort of interpretation of an Art of Fighting character, which is why Jason and I got kind of sad at the SNK slot machine being an Art of Fighting slot machine. You looked like you had something else to say.
Oh, that they actually, after Dan was made, they counteracted and made their own character. I can't remember what his name was.
They did. They made, I want to say it was almost like an Akuma ripoff or something.
I can't remember, but he just, woo, yeah. It wasn't as funny as Dan.
I'm just going to call him Mr. Demon. I don't know. Samurai Showdown, of course, is a series which, to this day, sometimes gets releases in its franchise. And those original games were so good that even though these newer games are awful, it's still a well-loved series.
Actually, Samurai Showdown was my favorite in comparison when it came to, like, play Street Fighter 2 or Samurai Showdown. I would prefer Samurai Showdown. I thought it was a great game. Most versions of it, like Samurai Showdown 1, 2, and going on, you know, I loved them. I thought they were great. But you're right. Going further down the line,
Yeah. I think 2 and 3 were sort of the pinnacle of that series.
Agreed. But I still have a heart for 64.
Yeah, that... It really bothers me that game is basically impossible to play in this day and age. Samurai Showdown 64, and I'm going to diverge very briefly here just for the briefest of moments, was not a Nintendo 64 game. It was a game, it is a 3D fighter, based, of course, on Samurai Showdown. It has Samurai Showdown. It occurred to me this whole time I've been calling the series Samurai Showdown. If you're super anal retentive, it's probably bothering you that I'm not calling it by its Japanese name of Samurai Spirits. In any event, I basically just wanted to tell y'all that I'm not going to call it Samurai Spirits. But we know. So Samurai Showdown 64 was launched on a basically otherwise useless arcade board known as the Neo Geo 64. As far as I'm aware, this hardware does not exist in any context other than Samurai Showdown 64, Samurai Showdown 64 2, and Fatal Fury Wild Ambition.
Oh.
What?
I was seriously, and then you just named all three games. All of them great games, though.
and as far as I'm aware, this was only arcade hardware. Fatal Fury Wild Ambition did get a PS1 port a little bit down the line, but as I recall, it was diminished from its original arcade release. I don't believe that these games are emulatable, even at this point. I don't think that there are drivers in MAME that are set up for that hardware or whatever. And I think it's a tragedy.
And if you do know of an emulator that can emulate this, please hashtag them or comment them, and I would download that crap and shit right now.
Yeah, no, I obviously, we here at GameBuoy, we do not support or advocate piracy.
Sorry about that.
Irony being that we're pirates.
That having been said, it is our opinion that if a game is not made available at retail in any context, that purveyors of the form of gaming really need to sort of step up and archive this stuff, because it would really be a shame if no one in the future ever plays Samurai Showdown 64. I'm not being facetious. That would be a shame.
No, I agree.
Moving forward, in this same window of time, we also have Sega's release of Eternal Champions. Now, some of you might be aware, in this window in the early 90s, Nintendo had the Super Nintendo out, Sega had the Genesis/Mega Drive out. But Capcom only brought Street Fighter 2 to one of those consoles, and it wasn't the Genesis/Mega Drive. So Sega did the next best thing and had a fighting game made. This fighting game is, of course, Eternal Champions. It was a Western-developed fighting game. I know that's something that Sidekick has a particular interest in.
Well, I wouldn't say interest.
And it featured what is probably one of my very favorite rosters of characters in all of fighting games.
Very unique roster.
There was an alchemist who could throw around bolts of magic that would turn people into, like, solid gold. There was, like, an Atlantean, like, fish monster with, like, a trident for a hand way before Aquaman did it.
Yeah.
There was, like, a gangster from the 30s and a cyborg from the future and, like, a caveman from the past and, like, a ninja assassin from the current day and age.
I would like to see a movie of this made.
It would be awful.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the game sort of died in obscurity. There was a Sega CD sequel. I have a copy. I love it. But it was not... It never blew up. It never really caught on.
It didn't really caught on. And if I recall right, I might be wrong on it, but when you're comparing to, like, the tightness of the controls for Street Fighter, it was a little loose. I can imagine trying to pull off moves. I remember. Maybe it was just me and my inability to be dexterous, but... I tried to pull off some moves in Eternal Champions. It just didn't work out all the time, so...
Yeah. Huh. Now, there was, in this same 1992 window, a rather major fighting game release. Probably... Oh, and I see Seawolf Jason literally pantomiming television advertisements.
Oh, I thought he was fist-pumping like a Guido.
No. Jason, do you want to do that again once more with volume? Mortal Kombat! So, Mortal Kombat came out, and it was basically awful, and that's all we're going to talk about Mortal Kombat. No,
I mean, that's fine.
I'm being facetious. You know, Mortal Kombat was really popular because it was super bloody, because it was a viable fighting game where all of the characters had really unique movesets, all of the characters played well, controlled well. It introduced the block button, which I'm not the biggest fan of, but I appreciate that they were actually trying new things rather than just cloning what had been done. And have I mentioned those digitized actors? Because that was also a big deal. The game's presentation effectively utilized digitized images of real people acting out these moves and hits. And for a lot of people, it brought a level of realism to the genre that I guess felt was lacking. I mean, I don't know. I still think that, you know, Kano shooting someone with an eye laser to melt them or whatever the hell he did. Or that was a later Mortal Kombat game. I guess in that one he ripped out people's hearts and squeezed it in his fist.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if that's that much more realistic than Ryu throwing a fireball, but whatever. To each their own.
Now, I always viewed Mortal Kombat as the Pepsi to Street Fighter's Coke or the Burger King to Street Fighter's McDonald's.
I view it as something a little different. To put it into perspective, I viewed Mortal Kombat as, well, Street Fighter was the gamer's game, and Mortal Kombat was really the bros or the frat boys.
Like the proto-bro, yeah.
It's kind of like, yeah.
Protos.
No, it's kind of like how Halo brought this whole mentality into first-person shooters. They brought that into fighting in the arcade.
That's a really valid point, yeah.
Yeah, I actually, and it's funny because when you put it that way, I remember the way the arcade scene changed.
Totally changed after that.
You know, all of those of us that were playing Street Fighter and learning Street Fighter and doing learning combos and communicating over, like, bulletin boards and, like, word of mouth at arcades. And then suddenly these people were coming in who were just like, yeah, like, I'm a punk 13-year-old kid, not punk in, like, the cool punk rock sense, but punk, like, in the kind of trashy sense. Like, I'm gonna come in, and I'm gonna make this game have hella blood, and I'm gonna uppercut you over and over and over and over and over and have no style or tact, but it's cool because he's bleeding, and I totally know how to do Sub-Zero's fatality with forward, down, forward, low punch, and it just rip off your spine.
No, yeah. And that's how it was. I mean, don't get me wrong, there was a deep fighter within it, but the blood and the guts and everything got everyone coming in. It's like, oh man, I could hit you when you bleed. And it's like, yeah, but you're...
And it's funny because, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You know, that's what we think about when we think about Mortal Kombat, is the fatalities, the bloodiness of it. And I guess it's kind of unfortunate in the sense that...
I don't know that that's still true. But I think that was true for, like, 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unfortunate that that's perception of it.
I think they probably only really just got past that perception with the release of the reboot of the franchise a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that was the first time people really took Mortal Kombat as a serious fighter. It took them that long, like, 20 years, to get past, like, blood and spines, and Sonya's gonna kiss you with a little fire butterfly, and it's gonna set you on fire or something.
And babalities.
Friendship.
That's why I say it's the Pepsi to...
Oh, because it's a try-hard.
Yeah. Or Burger King until they reinvented their menu.
Yeah, no. I say this all, but obviously, like, I still remember the moves. I still remember how those games play. I still remember how in Mortal Kombat 2 to make Shang Tsung turn into Kintaro for his fatality. It sucked because you had to sort of sacrifice using half your moves because you had to hold a button for like 30 seconds, which is up forever in a fighting game.
Yeah. Do you know what I remember very clearly?
What do you remember very clearly?
I remember
clearly?
Mortal Monday.
Yes, yes, the date that the Mortal Kombat games were released at home. And of course that itself is its own talking point because, as you probably remember, the Super Nintendo version of Mortal Kombat had all of the blood changed to gray sweat, and all of the fatalities were changed. All of the ones that were deemed sort of extreme. So you would have, you know, rather than ripping someone's heart out, I think you just, like, punched them hard.
Actually, with Sub-Zero, I believe he froze people and shattered them.
Well, I was talking about the Kano one, because Sub-Zero was ripping people's heads off and their spines hanging down.
Yeah. But you're right, Kano, I think he might have punched them really hard.
I feel like maybe, but maybe not. But I actually really liked the Sub-Zero one where instead he freezes them and shatters
them.
Kind
of cool.
I liked that
one. And then they created a new fatality after that.
And I feel like for Johnny Cage, like, it was supposed to be like some sort of like super epic kick or something, and they turned it into just like a punch or something.
I don't remember.
You know, what's interesting is that you mentioned that, and it's probably for that reason that I associate Mortal Kombat more with the Genesis in terms of home consoles.
Because you had to enter in that button code. It was like A, B, B, A, C, A, B, B, A, or something.
I thought you were going to just name the code like that, so...
That's what I was trying to do, but then I realized, like, I remember how it starts, and I remember sort of the flow of it, but the exact number of times you hit each button, I don't remember anymore.
But yeah, the famous blood code.
It also had the down, up, left, left, A, right, down code, which opened up the debug menu. I only remember that because it spells out Dullard. So... and that was cool. Lots of, you know, Reptile was a hidden character. Yep. That's something to talk about. That game had a hidden character way before it was cool to do hidden characters.
It did. It did have a hidden character that was way before.
And you would get to him and you could fight him down in the pit, which was, of course, also a really important aspect that we totally neglected
to
mention.
We did, about the uppercut.
Environmental fatalities. If you were on, like, the pit, which was like a little bridge that was over a pit of spikes, and you uppercutted for fatality rather than inputting a real fatality code, you would knock their body off of the bridge and down into the spikes below.
Yes.
And which was kind of groundbreaking at the time, because otherwise, like, occasionally in Street Fighter, if you got hit in the right spot, maybe, like, a barrel would break or something, but it would have no impact on game, and it was super unreliable, not really, like, a real thing that was going on.
Yeah.
But in Mortal Kombat, it was like, nope, you're interacting with this background right now because you totally just knocked that guy into a pit of spikes. Have fun with that.
I always thought, before we move on, I always thought that the, and this is coming from the perspective of an 8-9-year-old boy, I always thought that the Mortal Kombat characters were a little more like, ooh, rough, tough, and badass. And I mean, I guess that's kind of what you were referring to, like, in the demographic as well, but like, I always thought, like, Raiden, Sub-Zero were, like, super badass. Not that I don't think that characters in Street Fighter are badass, but, you know, it's just kind of had that more, like, ugh.
Well, it's very stereotypical, like, extreme! Like, oh yeah, no, we don't have, like, respectful karate master students that want to be the best at their game. We have, like, top secret martial artist special forces who's after this notorious terrorist.
Punch people to death. But I kind of
exactly.
Liked that difference.
Well, it definitely gave both games different flavors, and you know, so it definitely they're very different. And especially looking back, I think it's a lot easier to appreciate exactly how much Mortal Kombat brought to the table. I was, I guess, maybe a little bit of a hipster as a kid. I played Mortal Kombat and I liked it, but I definitely would be like, oh, Street Fighter's better. I just play this because it's what everyone plays. And I do. I still prefer Street Fighter, but I appreciate that Mortal Kombat was something pretty special. Just a little bit more I want to talk about in this time period, and then I want to move forward. There was, very interestingly, several clones of in particular, Street Fighter II. You know, we were talking earlier about how the roots of the series, of the genre were in clones. Data East made in 1993 a arcade fighting game called Fighter's History. You might be familiar with, of course, the later Neo Geo Fighter's History Dynamite games, but I'm talking about the original release, which Capcom USA felt was so similar to Street Fighter that they actually attempted to take legal action, much like the...
Data East took legal action before, yeah.
Yeah, Data East had previously done basically the exact same thing, and Data East's response in court to Capcom was basically, we made Karate Champ before Street Fighter, so y'all are copying us. And the court basically agreed. Data East was able to leave Fighter's History out and even do sequels.
Interesting.
And sort of getting to the beginning of what you might consider modern fighters, of course, is that in the 93-94 release window, Sega released the first Virtua Fighter game.
Ah, yes.
This is, of course, the first fighting game with 3D polygon graphics. You know, the viewpoint zoomed in and out. There was depth. There wasn't any real play to the depth. You couldn't sidestep into the foreground or background like you would think expect from later fighting games. But if you want to look at where fighting games are now, the first Virtua Fighter is a very important step in that transition, I'd say.
I agree.
I don't really have a lot to say about Virtua Fighter because it is such a deep and complex game that I could more easily explain the intricacies of chess to you than I could explain the intricacies of Virtua Fighter.
There's a ninja.
There isn't. Well, I mean, yeah, okay, but I'm talking about from a gameplay perspective.
I know.
So, of course, you know, we started to see the cavalcade of sequels that the genre would become known for and eventually sunk by in 93. You know, Mortal Kombat 2 came out. That's sort of, I guess, the big one. But in the 94 window, Street Fighter released, you know, Super Street Fighter 2.
Super Street Fighter Tournament Edition.
Yeah.
Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo.
Yeah, it started to get really out of control with the sequels and what have you. We had original releases, of course, in the PlayStation launch title in 1994, Battle Arena Toshinden. I know that you love that game, and I'll never understand it because it's objectively awful. Like, I'm not even talking about, like, oh, I dislike that. Like, no, that is, like, standing aside and just looking at the game on paper, that's a bad game.
I don't know what it was about that game. I just, maybe it was, there was a little Asian man that went on to tie up a giant, like, energy ball and just ran people over that I just loved. But, I don't know.
You know, I recently bought a copy of that game on CD. We're about to play it after we record this.
Okay, that's fine with me.
We're going to play Toshinden for you, the listeners. Maybe we'll see if we can get Slagkick to record it with some commentary. It's all going to be like, girl, you just hit him hard. Obviously, we're getting into the slap-happy portion of the night, getting a little punch-drunk as we tend to do on these night recordings.
Game Buoy Nights.
Oh, I like that.
Game Buoy After Dark. That implies it's going to be a little sexy in here.
It might, because in the same year in which Battle Arena Toshinden hit, SNK consolidated their fighting franchises that we spoke previously of, aside Samurai Showdown, into the King of Fighters series, with King of Fighters 94.
I think that was great marketing I had. I mean, the idea they had all these little tiny fighters that some people knew, some people didn't know about, and they just said, hey, let's put it into one giant fighting game and see what sticks. And it ended up being awesome. It was like, oh, look. There's Terry.
I definitely think that between Street Fighter and Street Fighter 2, Street Fighter 2 Turbo, Super Street Fighter 2 Champion Edition, Super Street Fighter 2, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, the Mortal Kombat games, all of these little side games, Fighter's History, Toshinden. I definitely feel like, Fatal Fury, Art of Fighting, even games like World Heroes. Like, the SNK games were sort of not as popular for a minute.
They weren't.
And then King of Fighters came along, and suddenly you had this game with this roster of way more characters than any other fighting game had. Fighting in tag teams. It really became a huge deal, especially in Japan, where the fighting scene was really, really quite different from the U.S. fighting scene.
They basically improved upon the genre, and they said, hey, you know what, they had, and it's not like this company that just came out of nowhere and made fighting games. They had this history of fighting games, even though most people didn't realize they had this history. And
would you say they had an art of fighting?
Go on. And then they just said, hey, what do we learn from this? What do we learn from our competitors? Let's put this in the game. And they're like, bam, here's our game. And everyone's like, wow, this is amazing. And it was. It was amazing.
Yeah. And so, 95 rolls around. And, of course, in the U.S., Mortal Kombat is, actually really super huge. Mortal Kombat 3 in that time period. Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. In Japan, we have a couple of Virtua Fighter games out, and it's by far the most popular fighting series in Japan.
It was kind of a big reason why the Saturn was doing well for a minute, right?
It was probably one of the high points of the Saturn. I don't know if I would describe the Saturn as having been doing well.
Well, that, I mean, you know.
But, and, you know, somewhat interesting during this time, during this window of time, and I think this is sort of the sign of things to come, is that the Street Fighter series was sort of on its downswing. Capcom tried to revitalize the franchise by releasing Street Fighter Alpha, which was sort of a little faster paced, looser, sort of felt more like the SNK fighting games, had like sort of a fresher, younger, new, rejuvenated art style, more anime based.
It was definitely their retaliation to the King of Fighters game, because they had to change some things, and it was fresh, and it was fast paced, and it's hard to explain it, but it's like, with the Alpha series, a lot of people are like, wow, this is better. I find it kind of funny.
I find it kind of sad.
Well.
Continue.
No, I meant that the fact is they wanted a new look on it, and they wanted to make it fresh and young, so they took the history of Street Fighter and went back, like, 20 years or so, and no one really knew or cared, but, you know.
Yeah, ain't no one here for the Street Fighter storyline.
I just find it funny that they want a young, fresh look, so they took Ryu back and say, oh, he's younger now.
Oh, yeah, Ryu's a 16-year-old now. Have fun.
Would you describe Street Fighter Alpha as the new Coke of the Street Fighter franchise?
No.
No, because New Coke was a complete failure, and Alpha ended up a little bit down the line becoming a fairly respected sub-series.
Oh, so Street Fighter 3 would be the new Coke, then?
No.
No, because Street Fighter 3 is, like, one of the best fighting games of all time, in
really?
Pretty much everyone's opinion.
Okay.
Really?
Let me think. We're talking about Capcom games and New Coke. If we were doing that, then it would be...
I'm sorry for starting.
Huh.
Cyberbots?
Something like that. Or that one with the animal people. I can't remember that name.
Warzard? Red Earth?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that was... It was Warzard in Japan and Red Earth here.
So there we go. That's the New Coke.
All right.
Anyways.
I can officially bury that metaphor now.
The thing is, just to touch on something Sidekick just said, Street Fighter III was sort of a flop in terms of being profitable.
Okay.
But in terms of
mechanics,
the game, it is probably the closest any 2D fighter has gotten to the complexity and, like, timing of the Virtua Fighter series.
Now, see, it always struck me as the black sheep of the series, and maybe it's because it performed so poorly that people were just like, oh, it was a failure.
Well, it performed poorly enough. It was successful in its own way, but overall, it did not revitalize the franchise, and in a lot of ways was Capcom's sort of beginning of the end for their first real window of fighting games, which we'll get to.
But to go back to Alpha, the one thing that it started was, I hate this term, so I apologize for using it, but Twitch Fighters. It really started that idea of Twitch Fighters, because, you know, Mortal Kombat, Street Fighter, you know, King of Fighters, you really couldn't do button mashing, but Alphas really were, started with, like, all the hyper, like, lights and just button mashing that really started that.
Yeah, a lot less long play strategy and a lot more aggressive play.
And, like it or not, it did change the fighting game franchise.
Yeah. For some reason, I have left out in my notes here the Tekken series, but I believe that also popped up in this window of time. I'm not a Tekken fan. I have a really hard time talking about Tekken. Most of this stuff I can just jot down off the top of my head, but Tekken, like, kinda can't.
My thing was Tekken. I never really got into it, maybe because also at the same time I was into projectiles, and I'm like, this is a fighting game that doesn't have projectiles. I don't get it. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of intricacies in Tekken, but, you know, it just wasn't my type of game. And also once I heard about the infinite throw combo that some characters can just throw people without ever stopping, it was like, I'm done.
Well, Tekken released in arcades in 94 and on the PlayStation in 95, so this is the time window that we're talking about, since we are actually talking still about that 94-95 window. Something else that came out in that same window would be Samurai Showdown 2. which we previously regarded as basically the best Samurai Showdown game. I'm not really going to talk about Street Fighter II, the movie, the game.
Why would we?
Exactly.
You've already said too much.
Yeah, I mentioned its name. I'm so sorry to everyone out there. You know, I actually own a copy of that. Say that loud enough for the mic to get.
Burn it.
Yeah, I'm not going to burn it.
He should.
I'll burn you a copy. No, I won't, because I'm not into that.
Anybody want to see Captain Spike burn the game? Hashtag burn the game.
Hashtag burn the game.
Seawolf Jason might have to be our new social media consultant or something. Yeah. He's making these hashtags.
Seawolf Jason is really good at Twitter. I was just telling Space Pirate Ben that for their show, NPCs Only, Seawolf Jason should really be their social media guy because he gets it.
Yeah.
So, I'm just going to real quick gloss over the sort of vague part of history, because we're sort of getting to where I wanted to cut off for part one of this the origin of fighting games.
Origin of fighting.
And that is, of course, 97, Soul Edge came out, known as Soul Blade in its home releases. I might have that a little bit mixed up, my bad. I always think of it as Soul Edge in any event. Tecmo, of course, in 96 released Dead or Alive, a series which is still running to today. Soul Edge / Blade, obviously, is still running today as Soul Calibur. In 98, Bushido Blade was released by Square.
Yeah.
One thing I want to talk about Bushido Blade that I really liked was it was a unique, fresh perspective on fighting games, because we had this idea of fighting where people threw fireballs and uppercuts, and nothing happened. They got up. They had a life bar. Bushido Blade introduced this idea of realistic combat, that you could literally kill someone in one hit. If you had a sledgehammer and you hit them in the head, they would die.
Yeah, no second chances. You were dead. Like, sorry about it. LOL, goodbye.
My favorite moment in Bushido Blade is there's a boss. You fight all these guys with swords and nunchucks and mallets and stuff, and finally you fight the first boss. And he doesn't have a weapon. You're like, okay, what's up? I'm ready for him. And he just says shine, which is the Japanese word for die. He pulls out a gun and shoots you.
And if you get hit, you're dead, because you just got shot, and you ain't got no armor or nothing. Like, nope, you're dead.
And it was, like, crazy. And you didn't expect it. You just all of a sudden, like, round one, fight. I don't even know if they said round one, fight. You're like, shit, boom, you're dead. Like, what the fuck? This guy just shot me.
Yeah. Another entry by Square into the fighting genre, of course, is Toeball Number 1.
Yeah.
This game is probably mostly notable for having characters designed by Akira Toriyama of Dragon Ball fame.
Yep.
In the US and Japan, it was released with the sampler disc featuring the pre-release demo of Final Fantasy VII.
And Smart. Didn't actually have a Final Fantasy VII character in the game?
In Toeball, I don't think so. I think you're thinking of Air Guys.
Oh, maybe I am.
That Namco crossover game that was Tekken and...
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. Sorry.
And before anyone calls me out on the fact that Erekai's didn't have any actual Tekken characters in it, I'm just going to point out that they're all, like, siblings or cousins or something. They share last names and settings.
I actually have a copy of that game somewhere.
You have a copy of Erekai's?
Yeah, somewhere.
You just wanted the final... You wanted Sephiroth in a fighting game.
Yeah. I mean, I bought everything... I bought everything Squaresoft at that point. That's why... I bought Vagrant Story, which fortunately ended up being a good thing.
Yeah, no,
I don't think
Erekai's
is a very
game.
Good fighting game.
I like Erekai's, but it's not incredible, but I like it.
I don't think it was very good.
I like it. It's not very good, but I like it. Another really notable thing about Toeball Number 1, first off, is that it had, like, complete three-dimensional movement, which of course meant, you know, you had to, like, use a button to jump or whatever, but you could move up and, like, forward into the background and sort of toward you into the foreground super easily. And also, it was locked at 60 frames a second solid on the PlayStation 1. Which is, of course, a feat that most fighting games in this day and age still can't do on their respective hardware.
Amazing.
From a technical perspective, yeah. They just did all, like, flat-shaded, Garode-shaded polygons with no textures. But they did it in such a way that the characters still look good and stylized. They don't just look like a plain blob set of blocks.
Oh, you it's mean like Final
Cube
Fantasy
Cube Man
VII.
Versus Square Man.
Yeah. Yeah, yes to what to both of what you just said. And of course, I wanted to spend a little bit of time on Tobal number 1, because that'll be a little relevant a little later on. Let's see, we talked about Bushido Blade, we talked about Tobal number 1. Oh, another really important, whoever made these notes that I'm building on left out some super notable games, and I hate them for it. So, something we didn't talk about is that Capcom did a fighting game loosely based on the X-Men animated series called X-Men Children of the Atom.
They did indeed.
This was, of course, a really popular game, widely known for its innovations in huge screen-filling super moves.
Mm-hmm.
You had the super jump sort of really emphasized for the first time in a Capcom game. That is to, you know, tap down before you jump in order to make your character jump up several screen lengths.
As far as I guess you can tell me otherwise, but that's the first game I know that had a super jump. Maybe other games did, but obviously screen lengths you...
Well, another game in that vintage, and it wasn't screen lengths, but I believe the Darkstalkers series, which is of the same vintage, also had super jumps.
Yeah, no.
It would only make you jump a little higher,
bit, yes. No,
but
right.
Still super jumps. So those are two games in this vintage that are both really worthwhile. We talk about Darkstalkers on this show all the time.
Yep.
So I don't feel a huge...
Darkstalkers are not dead.
Darkstalkers are not dead.
I mean, personally, it's one of my favorite fighting games. But, yes, I understand it didn't really revolutionize the genre.
Yeah, but it has a very dedicated, very loyal fan base. Not that you'd be able to tell by how poorly the recent Xbox Live and PlayStation 3 ports sold on the arcades... But
that's a shame.
But dedicated and passionate nonetheless. Of course, the Capcom X-Men game gave way to a Capcom Marvel Super Heroes game, which itself gave way to the only possible thing that could possibly happen, which was a crossover between the Marvel Super Heroes games and the Street Fighter games, which itself led to one of Seawolf Jason's favorite fighters, as far as I'm aware. Would you like to do the honors?
The next game?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about X-Men versus...
I was talking about MVC.
Oh, MVC, okay. Oh, yeah, MVC, yes, but I thought you were going to take small steps. I'm sorry.
No, I wanted to do big steps because we've been talking for 2 hours.
I understand. MVC. No. Yeah, Marvel vs. Capcom was a great game. But to go back with me personally in the fighting game genre, I kind of went out, and the Versus series brought me back in.
I remember that, actually. I do remember you playing a little bit of Alpha. I want to say primarily maybe Alpha 2.
Yeah.
But you know, for the most part, Jason would not get in on our fighting game shenanigans. We'd be playing, you know, Killer Instinct and what have you. And Jason was just not having that until Versus series. And I mean also, to some degree, X-Men and Marvel Super Heroes.
Yeah.
I have one particularly great story about Marvel Super Heroes, playing in an arcade with Jason in Vegas.
Yeah.
Thanos was involved.
No, I know. You want me to tell the story? It's your story, really.
No, it's your story.
Oh, well, anyways. No. So, anyways, he's playing, if you know the game, the Marvel Super Heroes game, he's Spider-Man, boss is Thanos, and Captain Spike, he's almost being Thanos. He had, like, a sliver of health left, so he's doing maximum spider. And, well, Thanos has super moves, so one of them is Soul Gem, which he then, you know, basically rips the soul out of you and does massive amount of damage, and just kills him. And that was it, and I laughed at him. And it wasn't
I know what's going to happen next.
And it wasn't very funny, but it was funny to me. And, well, long story short, let's fast forward to MVC 2, where there's Thanos in it, and of course Spider-Man. And I purposely, most of the time, pick Thanos just to Soul Gem him. And one time we were playing, and I was losing, and he had Spider-Man, and I had Thanos, and I had a sliver of health, and he did a Maximum Spider, and I did Soul Jam. And he went, Soul Jam, and I won.
That is exactly where I thought the story was going.
And so...
It's pretty awful, you douche.
But besides that, I think the Versus series really created this hyper-fantasy fighting game genre. It did it big and bright and beautiful, and I think it kind of led the way to what I think is one of the best fighting games ever, which is actually not Capcom related, but I think it helped with it.
Yeah, no, I don't think that can be stated enough, really. I'm going to talk about the last game now. It's not really a fighter. The last game I'm going to talk about in this segment of the history of fighting games. I've had a lot of fun talking about fighting games with you, Jason. We're going to do a part two. We're going to have a different guest on. Maybe we'll also have you on. It'll just be our first four-way. Game Boy After Dark. But the game I want to talk about right now Marvel vs. Capcom. I'm getting loopy. I want to talk about Super Smash Bros. All-Star Dairen Tao Smash Bros.
Super Smash Bros.
Just the first one today.
Okay.
Because we're going to cut this off in 1999.
But in general, with the Smash Bros., it was a weird idea because how I felt about it is because they were saying it's a Nintendo fighting game, and we're like, how does Nintendo do a fighting game? I think they revolutionized the idea and our concept of what a fighting game is.
And let me ask you this, because this is a popular debate. You know, this game does get played at EVO. EVO, for those of you who don't know, is sort of like the big deal, like the main fighting game championship tournament in the world that's held annually. Generally, I want to say the last few years in Vegas, possibly always, I don't know. I don't know the history of EVO. I should have learned, but I planned on talking about that in part two of this discussion. So they play Smash Brothers at EVO. Clearly, there are a lot of people who view Smash Brothers as a fighting game, but there are also a lot of people who don't, because, as you say, it sort of changed what people perceived a fighting game to be. So this question goes out to both of you. How do you feel about the status of Smash Brothers as a fighting game?
They fight, end of story.
See, I...
Characters in Final Fantasy fight, is that a fighting game?
Yes.
It is if it's Garland, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't view it separately, like, in a negative way, but I do look at it differently than I would look at a Street Fighter or a Mortal Kombat or a King of Fighters or any of these other ones that we've talked about. I mean, there's, you know, some, like, the Soul series, more weapon-based, so that was a little bit different flavor, but, I mean, I really feel like Smash Brothers just feels different than a, you know, it's probably because up to four players, you know, you think of most fighting games as one versus one.
But going on that, I know we're going a little off topic, but Power Stone, four-player fighting game, and people consider that a fighting game, and it was almost on the same level.
Was Power Stone a launch game? I know that the Dreamcast launched with a demo disc that had a demo for Power Stone, but did Power Stone hit at the same time as
well? I believe it was a launch game. If not, it was shortly
after. Well, then that means it came out on 9/9/99, which means we can talk about it here, because we're talking about 99.
Because Power Stone, I thought, was a great game.
Power Stone is absolutely one of my favorite multiplayer games.
And I'm sad that there was only two of them.
Me too. It really upsets me that there's not, like, a current-gen port, at least. Like, give me some Power Stone love on Xbox Live Arcade.
I agree. But going back to Smash Brothers... the idea when you're talking about fighting games, what is a fighting game? Well, growing up with games and fighting games, and we had to deal with, like, you know, Street Fighter, and this is what a fighting game is. Then Mortal Kombat came out, and that changed what fighting games was. And then we're like, okay, this is fighting games. Then Tekken came out, and that changed what fighting games were. People just need to get off their high chair, and Street Fighter, or the Street Fighter, and this is what fighting games are. Smash Brothers, they revolutionized what a fighting game is. They changed it. So this is now what can also be a fighting game.
Yeah. You know, I actually, I totally agree with that. And I think that that's personally why I included that game in this discussion, because I know that it's sort of a talking point, like, oh, is that even a fighting game? But for me, like, it clearly, it is. It changed what a fighting game can be, but...
Yeah, it revolutionized the genre.
When I think of Smash Brothers, and I don't mean this in, like, a, oh, Nintendo makes games for kids way, but I feel Smash Brothers is a lot more accessible than some of the more, like, hardcore fighting games. I'm more comfortable playing Smash Brothers than I am playing even a Street Fighter game, just because of the skill level involved. I think it's more forgiving. But also just the feel of it's different, you know, just like kind of, it's chaotic, but not in like a messy way, but it's just kind of like, it's like, you know, four people like just duking it out, and then someone will get the hammer and it's like, and then someone gets hit by a, like a Blastoise. I mean, and I think that's part of what makes it feel really unique and special. Yeah. I love Smash Bros.
I think unique and special are both two really good words for that.
Oh, there's one thing that actually I think that you brought up that actually I would consider that Smash Bros. Did help change the fighting genre on other games was, you're right, it had simplistic controls. And if we actually look at the generations coming up further for fighting games, which they, I wouldn't say dumbed down because that sounds bad, but they made more simplistic.
They streamlined. I'm going to say streamlined.
Streamlined is a good word, yes.
And we are going to talk about that. You know, of course, Tatsunoko versus Capcom was a big part of the fighting streamlining, and Marvel. I said Marvel versus Tatsu? Did I say that, or did I say something?
You said Tatsunoko.
No. Oh, thank gosh. Okay, it's getting late, and I'm getting dumb. You know, Marvel versus Capcom 3, of course, also streamlined. And I do think that you can see the roots of that in this window of time where... sort of the emphasis came on sort of accessible play.
Well, I mean, for me, that's really important because I like fighting games, but I'm not really good at them. And I mean, when we get to our listener feedback today, I'm not the only one who feels that way. But so that's why I think Smash Brothers was important for me, because it made me feel like, oh, hey, I don't have to memorize all these combos in order to have fun in a fighting game, you know? So I think that was what was significant for me. And I also love the N64, so, I mean, you know, there's that too.
All right, I'm going to wrap up this part of the discussion. We are going to have one more part of this discussion, but it's actually going to go really fast.
Yeah, you got to keep it moving.
Yeah, not that we just kept that moving. That was a lot of talking.
No, I learned a lot because, you know, I'm not as knowledgeable about this stuff, so I learned a lot listening to you two.
Excellent.
And hopefully our listeners did as well.
Hopefully they did, and hopefully, you know, a lot of this we were sort of going off our how we remember things. We did have a little bit of help from the internet, but most of this was just us going off the top of our head. I apologize if we got the dates a little fuzzy or if it was hard to follow.
They don't care about that.
It's also past midnight, so y'all gotta respect.
After dark.
Gangly.
Hashtag.
So, I'm going to talk about a couple of big-name fighting games. The lists that you guys have are no longer perfectly accurate, because I think I'm just going to have Jason come on for a four-way when we come back to this topic. So, you've been invited to a four-way, and you're expected to attend.
I just thumbed up, so you can't see that, I realize.
Excellent. Well, I assume that means it's agreeable, and you're at least having a little bit of fun.
Of course, that's fine.
Delightful. Street Fighter. Just want to real quick talk about what you guys think. Jason, you're probably the best choice here. Street Fighter as a series, how do you feel about the complexity and accessibility of Street Fighter?
Ooh, that's tough. As a series, I think it's most well-known fighting game, and I think it has its roots where I think people can pick it up and start. It's a lot of people's first fighting game, and I think, in general, it's a good place to start.
Excellent.
I think it has really memorable characters. Chun-Li, Guile, Zangief, Ryu. I mean, I'm specifically talking about two, of course, but, you know, those are such memorable characters, even for someone like me who's not as hardcore of a fighting game fan.
Excellent. I think that that's actually, like, really a really good insight, because I often, you know, I talked about the characters of other games. You'll notice I talked a lot about the characters in Eternal Champions. I talked a lot about the characters in... Mortal Kombat. I didn't really talk about the Street Fighter characters because they're so ingrained in my psyche. I don't really appreciate how well designed and how memorable those characters
are. Yeah, and I think that's an important part of their success is that people are attached to these characters. Like, I'm a big Chun-Li fan.
I'm a big fan of Zangief and Dalsim.
Oh, yeah.
And like Ken.
And Blanca. Hey, anyone with a green man who electrocutes people, that's awesome too. So, you know.
No, I'm just on a, like, a totally, like.
On a totally, like.
Awesome
fishery. I always thought his name was Dalsim.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Japanese have a different sound for that SI sound. Oh.
So are we going to
start calling M. Bison Vega then?
That's a super valid point.
Shit. So anyway.
See, I just have to say, I love Vega, and what was Vega's name in Japan?
Balrog.
I can't think of Vega as Balrog. I think of him as Vega.
Me too.
And I love Vega.
The fighting game community often refers to those three, Balrog, Bison, and Vega, as just Claw, Dictator, and Boxer.
Now, the thing that's weird is that M. Bison and Balrog, I don't really have an issue with, but Vega...
Well, that's because Balrog in Japan was called M. Bison because he's just Mike Tyson.
Right, right.
And they couldn't do that in America because they get sued.
Right, but I don't care about the other ones' names. Like, they could have switched those, but Vega is Vega to me. That's just... Deal with it if you have a problem. Yeah.
Let's try to go over these just a little faster. I'm gonna bundle these three SNK Neo Geo fighting games into one bundle. Fatal Fury, Art of Fighting, World Heroes. Jason, do you think there's any reason for people to go back and play these games?
Not Art of Fighting.
First Mate, Slag Kick. How would you feel if I sat you down and made you play Art of Fighting?
I'd rather play World Heroes Perfect to have Rasputin's gay... finishing move.
Fair answer. I'm not even going to ask how you feel about them as accessibility, because as we discussed, I don't think they're worth playing, frankly. Unless you're interested on a historical note.
Yeah.
In which case, by all means, check them out. You know, they're widely available on the digital shops, on PlayStation Network, the Wii shop, whatever it was called, the original Wii, and probably some of them are up on Xbox Live Arcade, too. Mortal Kombat.
My thing with Mortal Kombat is this. I personally think, we're talking about the older games, it was history, it's great, whatever. Maybe check out the new one to see how you feel about it. It's totally different, stylized than your Street Fighter style, and some people, they like it better. And for them, that's great. So if you want to, check it out. Check out the new one. I wouldn't go back to the old ones. I think they're done. They're over, you know, unless you want to see Babalities and laugh at them.
Babalities.
Which is interesting because I feel like a lot of Street Fighter fans, specifically, too, love to go back and play the older entries.
I was going to touch on that when we got to Virtua Fighter.
Ah.
Is that Virtua Fighter and Street Fighter both, probably because of the way the games are designed, you can still go back to those older games and get something out of them from a gameplay perspective, not just historical knowledge. Like, it is worthwhile to go back and play these games.
Yeah.
Whereas for the SNK Neo Geo games, for the, you know, Mortal Kombat, like, some of these newer iterations are great, but the classic ones, like, no, it's not really worth going back, unless you want to just see the spectacle and have a historical appreciation.
Mm, I agree.
Next one I want to ask about is Eternal Champions. Y'all know how I feel.
I like Eternal Champions. Do I feel people need to go back and play it? Well, I want to say yes, but...
Do people need to eat ice cream? No, but it's still cool to do.
Exactly. That's how I feel about it.
I feel like I need to play it for the historical perspective because... Like you said, it sounds like it has a really interesting cast of characters, and, you know, I'm with you. I like story in games. I'm not really here for story in fighting games, but characters in fighting games, I think, is an important part of the engagement.
And the next game?
The next game that I'd like to discuss here a little bit is King of Fighters.
I love King of Fighters. I'm trying to say. I personally, I might say go and... play the latest one, what the latest one is.
I'm going to disagree a little bit, because they have these super newish ones. It's like King of Fighters 12 or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to say play a King of Fighters from the early 2000s.
Well, I think of, when I think of King of Fighters, was King of Fighters 2000 or 00 or... What, or 03, 04, I can't remember, I apologize, but...
Okay, but finish your thought.
That's the King of Fighters I think of, and it's probably because I remember when I first befriended Captain Spike, we went to a local arcade, and he got super excited. He's like, oh, have you ever seen King of Fighters before? And I hadn't really been exposed to it before that, so... I mean, I think that's kind of what I associate King of Fighters with, is that era as well.
I was going to say, suggest I start at, I believe they're 95, right? They had a 95.
There was a 94 and a 95, definitely. To me, 97, 98 is where it really got super good.
Maybe I'm right. I know it was the 90s. I was like, start there and just go work your way up and just see which one clicks with you the best.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm pretty sure that quite a few of these, that was King of Fighters 11. Sidekick that you were talking about, it wasn't from 2011.
Was it with Roman numerals, XI?
Yes.
Okay, that's the one, definitely, yeah.
Excellent. I think 98 is generally regarded as one of the really big ones, Jason. And I agree. I'm sure that a lot of these games are available on the various download channels. And I do think that they're worth checking out, because just really, really popular. It's easy to sort of downplay how popular and game-changery these games are as U.S. fighting game fans. But in Japan especially, there was and continues to be a pretty devoted scene to these games. Of course, if either of you have any thoughts about Tekken, now's the time to spill, because I don't.
I actually do have something to say about Tekken. I recognize that they're not really considered the best of fighting games. In fact, I would say some people probably regard them as pretty sloppy. That said, Tekken is probably one of the few, proper fighting games. Well, I mean, we talk about Smash, which I consider a little different, but, in terms of, one versus one fighting, Tekken's, the only one that I can, reliably do well on in an arcade. If I play arcade, MVC, if I play Arcade Street Fighter, I'm just going to get my ass kicked, but I can do all right with the Tekken game.
I have six words for Tekken: Bear Fighting Man in Leopard Mask.
Yeah, that sums up what I like about Tekken. Let's also mention that that bear is named Kuma.
Yeah.
So he's basically,
I love Kuma.
He's Bear the Bear.
My PlayStation Network.
Bear the Bear.
My PlayStation Network icon is Kuma.
You should probably feel bad about that.
All right.
I don't.
So, let's see. We're going to go over just two or three more games here. I want to ask what you guys felt about Killer Instinct. You know, this was actually a really important game in a lot of ways historically, and we didn't really get into it on the show, or on the main discussion, I should say. But this game was sort of trotted out by Midway in collaboration with Nintendo. It shared some staff with the Mortal Kombat franchise, and was sort of sold as being run on the prototype Nintendo 64 hardware at the time called the Ultra 64.
I remember.
And it wasn't.
No, it really wasn't.
Honestly don't remember Killer Instinct.
Killer Instinct, my thing about this.
It was very Dude Bro Extreme.
I was horrible at Killer Instinct, but I always played it because it had Saberwolf.
Of course.
So, I mean, guilty as charged, but I was horrible at the game. I just played because, I played as a werewolf!
Yeah, well, I'm not really surprised to hear that about you.
Yeah.
I like Killer Instinct a lot. I thought it was really interesting, that this game was even made, because who would have thought Nintendo would have been behind getting a fighting game made. And you know who else? What other studio that's very well known on Nintendo's side that worked on this game in collaboration with Midway was Rare.
One thing that I do want to say about this is it actually started the whole emphasis on, the other games had combos, but really...
Yeah, but this was, straight up, codified. You have, combo breakers. You have,
Combo breaker!
Yeah, all of these, Ultra Combo, and all of that sort of thing. So I don't know, it was pretty special. Like, it's easy to forget that Killer Instinct was a thing that was really important to the progression of fighting games.
It was.
And, you know, Mortal Kombat 3 also emphasized combos and linking attacks, but they were of the same vintage.
Yeah.
So it's still really fair to call either of them sort of the real keynote, like the real touchstone of the sort of growth and progress of that specific subsystem that is now in any and all fighting games.
Yeah.
Like, if you made a fighting game now that didn't have a combo system, people would be like, what? So, and it's just a thought. I don't really want to talk about Dead or Alive as a game series.
The only thing I remember of Dead or Alive, actually.
Most of these other series we're going to talk about when we do part two. Which, by the by, is also going to focus on a lot of games that you've probably never heard of. So that'll be more of a typical Game Buoy episode. So let's wrap up the discussion on fighting games with Soul Calibur.
There's one thing I want to talk about Dead or Alive. I know you want to skip it, but I remember I was on the console version, and you could, like, hack the age or whatever, and the boob would bounce up to their head or something.
What? We need context here. Dead or Alive would ask you... This was Dead or Alive, the Dreamcast one. Maybe Dead or Alive 2.
I don't remember which one.
And it would ask you how old you were, and the older you put your age in, the more breast physics there would be, the more boob jiggle. So if you put, like, I'm 5, like, they'd be completely static. If you put, oh, I'm 18, they'd have some bounce. You put, like, I'm 58, like, you're a pervy old Japanese man. They're bouncing. There was a really easy exploit that you where you could set it to, like, the highest single hex integer up to 255. basically, they would be flopping through their own heads.
And it was hilarious to watch.
And it was awesome. So, yeah, that's...
to Soul Calibur.
That was a really good... I wish that we could have ended the discussion there.
basically Dead or Alive equals boobs.
Oh, my God, boobs. Yeah, let's talk about Soul Calibur. Let's wrap it up. I'm a huge fan. Whoever talks about Soul Calibur just as a vehicle for Link from Zelda on the GameCube version of Soul Calibur 2 is getting kicked out this podcast.
I was not even going to say that.
Good. You were the one I was looking at.
My main thing with Soul Calibur was, I was introduced to it, and it was interesting, because to me, even though Samurai Showdown had weapons, to me it was like the first fighting game with weapons.
That's what I think, too.
Even though it's totally not true, you know?
Yeah, it's not, like, there was, you know, Namco had a Super Nintendo fighting game that we didn't really talk about called Weapon Lord.
Oh, no.
It was awful, but it was a weapon-based fighting game.
There...
Oh, Namco. I wonder if some of those people worked on Soul Calibur, since Soul Calibur is also Namco.
But I think Soul Calibur...
I will need to research that.
I think Soul Calibur really took that idea... and kind of put it in its own genre.
Yeah,
and it's totally true, because when I think about fighters with weapons, I think about the Soul series.
No, I totally agree with you. Like, I know I bring up these obscure games, and even Samurai Spirits Showdown, which isn't obscure at all, I hope.
Hopefully not.
When I think of weapon-based fighting games, I too think of Soul Calibur. And to its absolute credit, because it's super good. Like, after Soul Calibur, it was sort of like, this is how you do weapons-based fighting games. And I think it's really telling that a lot of people view Soul Calibur's peak at being, like, Soul Calibur 1 or 2.
Yeah.
Like, that is a game that just, out of the gate, it was hatched, completely grown, in its own shoes, and there was basically nowhere to go but down. Like, new Soul Calibur games are not even that bad. It's just they started so strong and they've basically not progressed because they were so strong.
I agree entirely. There was they started on top of the mountain, and when they're like, where can we climb from here? So they can't. They're just like, here we are. And they're like, what's new? And we're like, you can create your own character?
You can create your own character or play as Yoda and Vader or Ezio.
Yay!
I like Ezio, and I think he plays well in Calibur 5, so there is that. But whatever.
I like to talk about Ezio.
You can play Spawn, too.
So, Oh, yeah, Spawn or Necrid. So I'm going to wrap up this discussion of part one with a simple last question. Ideally, if you could keep this down to one sentence, that would be lovely. I'm going to ask Slagkick first so that Seawolf Jason can get his answer down to one question, because we down to one sentence, because we know that's going to be difficult. What's your favorite fighting game?
Smash Brothers to play Street Fighter 2 for the characters. Doesn't matter what Street Fighter 2, you know, just that kind
well,
of character.
Well, what if it's Street Fighter 4?
This is more than one sentence.
It is. Seawolf
Street
Jason.
Street Fighter 4 is kind of out of the timeline that we're talking about.
Done.
Today.
Done.
You asked me a digital question. Fuck
Seawolf
off.
Jason.
Mechanic-wise, Guilty Gear franchise, in my heart, Darkstalkers.
Excellent. We're going to talk a lot about Guilty Gear, Blaze Blue, Hokuto no Ken, Sengoku Basara X, basically all of the Arc System Works fighting games in Part 2. Because that is a huge part of that discussion. It's a huge part of the revitalization of the genre. It's a huge part of where the genre is at in this day and age. And the guest we have planned for that episode is also huge on those games, so that helps.
Delightful.
You know, for our first four-way.
Woo-woo!
In-game movie. After dark. After dark.
So with that having been said, let's get back into our normal routine. I know that y'all are probably tired of hearing us talk, so we're going to try to wrap this up as expediently as possible. It's time to talk about...
I said, hey! What's going on?
So this week I played Mega Man Zero 1. I played more Monster Hunter. And I played Super Mario World and Ice Climber.
When you say Zero 1, did you just mean the first Mega Man?
No, I actually meant Mega Man Zero, which is a sub-franchise of Mega Man, and I played the first game.
With, like, Zero the character.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I was like, did you just accidentally call it Zero because it was the first Mega Man?
No, it's a spin-off of Mega Man X.
The reason I asked is because the first Mega Man just hit Wii U Virtual Console.
And right? I bought it, but I have not played it yet.
That's why I thought you were talking about it. But okay, yeah, Mega Man Zero.
Yeah. Both my games of Super Mario World and Ice Climber were cut short by people who rage quit. There are people who listen to the show. You know who I'm talking about.
I do.
Can you rage quit at Ice Climber?
Why don't you ask Orange Lounge Radio host Rob Roberts? Slagkick, what did you play this week?
I've been playing a lot of Persona 4. I love it. I don't want to spend too much time talking about it because I feel like we'll revisit the Persona series someday, but I'm really into it, and that's what I was talking about all those hours ago when I said I was interested in the dating sim and stuff now. Well, I'm interested in, like, kind of diving into that. Not that Persona series or Persona 4 specifically is really a dating sim, but, you know, I'm really...
It has elements.
As much as I love the dungeon crawling elements of it, I really love these social links and such. And just that, the high school life part of it, like, I'm really engaged with it. So, I'm about 20 hours in, so, you know, I still have a ways to go. I'm in about July in the game calendar. But just really great cast of characters. You know, we talked about Kanji on our, LGBT episode. Love him. I just love how much, you can...
How much?
I love how much, passion for this game that, that Atlas had. I mean, you can just really tell that it was a labor of love.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean to cut you off, but I know if you're anything like me, you could probably talk about Persona 4 all damn
yeah,
day.
Yeah, I'm trying to make a point of saving
so,
it for later.
With that having been said, Seawolf, Jason, what have you been playing this week?
Two things, really. To go back to fighting games, Injustice Gods Among Us.
Oh, yeah?
I've been playing that for a while, and recently got into Monaco, What's Yours Is Mine.
excellent. I've heard nothing but good things about that game.
So good. It's Gauntlet with Guns. Well, it's more than that, actually, really.
I'm here for that. Excellent. Anything else to say?
I mean, of games I played, yeah, those are the two games I've been playing. Well, wonderful games.
Well, very good. And you like them both, so delightful.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't be playing them if I didn't like them.
Excellent. Well, let's keep it quick and get on to our...
Smash or Trash! Smash or Trash!
Wait, yeah. Two of them?
Yeah, that's right. We have two, count them two, smashes, and two, count them two, trashes this week. You know that Smash or Trash, of course, is the Game Buoy segment here where we take and typically give you two examples. I guess this week we're giving you four examples of articles that are both rappin' good and rappin' bad in games journalism this week. We have for you a smash coming out of the Penny Arcade Report, which sums up a rather, how do I say, near and dear to my heart controversy over at Kotaku regarding the game Dragon's Crown, where, you know, Kotaku, in particular, Jason Schreier had criticized the art in this game. You know, it has scantily clad women with breasts several times larger than their heads. And Kotaku had just posted a little quick image like, hey, yeah, this is probably really not called for. So one of the character designers and founder of Vanillaware Studios, whom is behind the game Dragon's Crown, we've talked about this game a lot here on Game Buoy. I really have been excited for this game. Basically a drawing of scantily clad hairy dwarf men in bikinis saying, oh, he doesn't like the art in our game. This gentleman, the founder of Vanillaware, posted this image on his public Facebook with the quote that, Kotaku doesn't like our art, perhaps this is more their taste. Implying, of course, that because they don't like the way women are objectified in games, they must be gay, and that was something that Kotaku should be shunned and laughed at for. This is obviously extremely problematic, given the bent that we take here at Game Buoy. Bent, somewhat literally, one supposes, or figuratively. That's not really literal. We're not literally bent. We're figuratively bent.
Yep.
So, anyway, it's a great read. We're going to link it on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
I definitely recommend you read it.
Yeah, kind of disappointing.
Penny Arcade Report does a really good breakdown of both sides of this conversation.
Penny Arcade Report is pretty top-notch, 100% of the time.
Let's see, our other smash this week is Eurogamer does a report on the quest for Shadow of the Colossus' last big secret. This is a really well-researched article where they talk about a group of gamers that have been working over the Sony official message boards to coordinate an effort to basically search every last inch of the code in Shadow of the Colossus to try and figure out if there's anything left hidden in that beautiful game.
Wow.
It's absolutely a really compelling read. I really, really, really encourage you to read it if you have even a passing interest in Shadow of the Colossus. As always, we'll link you over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And with that, I think it's time to get to our trashes. These are examples of really bad writing in games journalism.
Unfortunately, they're both from Kotaku this week.
So our original branding of Loltaku of the Week does apply.
You know, Kotaku had been getting... seemed to have been doing pretty well for a while, but...
Now,
two stinkers this week.
Interestingly, this is an article written by Jason Schreier. No offense to you, man. Schreier. I find you really rather agreeable when you're not writing articles like this. But basically, this article is called JRPG Censorship is Such a Silly Thing.
It's a tongue twister.
Everything is a tongue twister at 1 a.m.
Game Buoy After Dark. Game Buoy After Dark.
So, basically, they're just pissing and whining about JRPGs that have been censored historically in coming over to America. The one that really got my goat, of course, is that in Suikoden, the main character, well, two of the main characters are tied up, and they're being interrogated by the evil empire. The interesting thing is that in Japan they're being crucified, and in the U.S. they're just on straight stump posts. Of course, Kotaku posits that there's no narrative explanation for crosses, so if the developers at Konami wanted these characters to be hanging on crosses, then we should have let them hang on crosses. Of course, they immediately take it to a religious place, and truly, this was probably removed for the Christ-like imagery and what have you. But to me, a really important thing to keep in mind about crucifixion is that that is one of the most punishing ways to kill someone, because ultimately you die slowly of asphyxiation as the muscles in your body start to strain and lose the ability to support your weight.
I'm a little disturbed by how much you know about crucifixion.
That this is happening to children in this game could very well be why this was removed from the U.S. release, because frankly, while I'm sure no one would have noticed nor have really considered the implications of crucifixion in this way, they just see crosses and think Christ or whatever. This is really not an okay thing to have happening to kids in a game as far as U.S. Social standards and what have you go.
Yeah, I mean, like,
this would have been like an upgrade in rating in terms of, you know, T for teen, M to mature or whatever.
Right.
You seem to have thoughts on this.
I actually read this article, but no, I agree with that. That's actually, when you really think about crucifixion and like how they used to do, sometimes they might bleed to death because they hammer too many holes in them. But besides this point, that yeah, you basically hung there and waited until you basically could not support yourself. And even though back in the day it was a form of punishment, you're right. I agree that I understand why that was censored.
Yeah, the thing is, it serves no narrative point in the game explicitly other than to show that these characters are being tortured. I guess if you want to communicate that, then I guess that's fair, but I don't think that needed to be communicated in the game. I think it was an appropriate thing to remove, especially given the U.S. market for JRPGs when Suikoden came out in the 90s.
I think the problem with this article is that it just kind of, like, blows off the reason for censorship. And I feel like we have a lot we could say about censorship.
Yeah, I think in the future we're probably going to have to do an episode on censorship and games. Anyway, I do highly recommend that everyone load up this link to JRPG Censorship is Such a Silly Thing.
Even though we don't want to give bad articles more hits, we want you to see why it's a trash article.
Yeah, I want you to look at this, and then that way those of you at home, obviously you have to be at home if you're listening to this, you're not here in the studio with us. If you're trying to write about games, this is a good example of what not to do.
Can I take this last one? I just find
I want you to take this last one, because I would probably start ranting.
Why don't you tell them what the title is?
FYI, butts are off-limit in Nintendo games, but penises aren't.
Here's the context of that.
You knew it was going to be this, didn't you?
Here's the context of this article.
Okay, real quick, before you explain it, I have a simple question for Jason that I want to ask. Did this article offend you?
Did this article offend me?
Do you find their perspective offensive?
I think it was... I know what you mean. Yeah, I think it was done on the wrong way. Like, done at a... I can't articulate, I'm sorry.
Would you call this a trash article?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So basically, in Animal Crossing New Leaf, there is a statue which has a penis showing. And Kotaku's like, oh, so it's okay to show a penis in a game? The thing is, that statue, you might have guessed by the way I described it, is Michelangelo's David.
It is literally, like...
like, one of the most important pieces of art. In the history of ever.
My thing that about these two articles I've noticed, and it seems to be, I don't want to be talking trash about Kotaku, because I actually...
Oh, we've done it for a year, Jason.
I'm just saying. Some of their articles are just, it seems to be, whiny little kids. And these two articles totally understand. Like, it's just me complaining about something I can't have my way. I get both about censorship, and there's a limit to censorship. I understand that.
Yeah.
But this was not the correct approach for it.
No, you're totally right, and that's why we try not to single out Kotaku, but more often than not, they're the worst offenders when it comes to this sort of whiny, and not really, like, it seems like they don't really think critically about things often enough. You know, we're not trying to bash them, like you said, but these guys are our voice.
You know, it's less, and I'm happy that you said this, because we used to state this during this segment in every episode, and I want to say it again. This is less about bashing Kotaku or anyone, because it's not only Kotaku. This is more about demanding better games journalism, because ultimately, you know, we look at these people's ads. We support these people's articles. I don't use an ad blocker ever, because I know that they need ad views for money.
Yeah, especially like, after that revealing report.
Yeah, so I really want to demand better coverage of games. Games are important to me, and I obviously think that there's a lot to say about games, and that maybe we should have a better quality grade of discourse about games rather than just sensationalist, awful articles where you talk about, LOL, Michelangelo's David has a penis and it's in Animal Crossing, ha 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 ha. Why can't we have panty shots in Nintendo games?
It's just ridiculous. It's ignorant, is what this one is.
Yeah, ignorant.
Doing the same thing.
Alright. So, shall we? In speaking of Persona, we have some social links.
So we asked a social links question of the week this week. I'm going to read the question for you, the prompt, and then Slagkick is going to read the responses.
Making me do the heavy lifting here, I see.
Yeah, okay, I've talked so much over the last 2 hours.
I'm giving you shit. Go for it.
This week, Game Buoy looks at the nay-impenetrable world of fighting games. What have your experiences with fighters been like? Have a fave?
So we got a tweet from Nintendog. In response to the first question, what have your experiences with fighters been like? Crap. And have a fave? No. So the tweet said, crap and no.
Well, Nintendug, we still really like you, but I'm sorry that you probably got nothing out of this week's show.
Well, that's not necessarily so. Maybe he's heard about something that might tickle his fancy. I'd like to tickle his fancy in Game Buoy After Dark. I'm sorry, okay. Nintendog, that was inappropriate.
Okay, on one hand, Game Buoy After Dark.
I'm
on
sorry
other,
to objectify you on
stop
the Nintendog.
Stop objectifying our listeners. They don't like it, probably.
Nintendog's used to it.
Well, assume he's not, he doesn't accept it, unless he tweets you with the hashtag, it's totally okay.
Which he has done in like
Doug,
the past 2 days.
Do not send the hashtag, it's totally okay. I'm giving you an out. Go on.
Space Pirate Ben left us a comment on our Facebook saying, I remember playing the original Street Fighter at the Union City Drive-In Theater.
That's local to where we all live.
Yeah, and being terrible at it. I used to get my ass handed to me when I was stuck using the Genesis 3-button controller on Street Fighter 2. I don't remember the name of Square's old fighting games, just that I'd play as a robot and turn myself off.
That's Tobal number one.
I can't remember if Killer Instinct was any fun to play, but I will never forget the term Combo Breaker.
Combo Breaker!
I didn't get good at fighting games until Capcom's Marvel license game. MVC games, I'm sorry. MVC will probably always be my favorite traditional 2D fighter, but Power Stone has some of my favorite memories.
Excellent. Yeah, I remember everything that Space Pirate Ben just said, so I'm probably a little biased. Like, I was there for most of those things.
Yeah, like, literally. Like, not just there in time, but there in time and place.
No, like, literally in the same room.
Time and place and space.
So,
Wicked!
But yeah, I agree. Space Pirate Ben, those were great times, and you have gotten really good at fighting games, and it's awesome.
He is good at fighting games. Wicked from the Nerdgasm Network video game podcast says, my first exposure was a local corner store getting a Street Fighter 2.
It makes it sound like herpes.
Well, see, when I first read this comment, I was like, oh, he was working the corner? My first exposure was a local corner store getting a Street Fighter 2 machine back in junior high, and it hooked me instantly. Fluid combat, vivid graphics, multiple characters, secret special moves. I had been playing stuff like Final Fight and Double Dragon beforehand. This just blew everything away. My favorite fighting games are ones that take the formula Street Fighter 2 and Mortal Kombat had cemented, both still great games, by the way, and do something new, like the Smash Brothers series or the Guilty Gear series. However, to this day, I dread playing Captain Spike in any fighting game, especially Super Smash Brothers Brawl. fucking chic.
Aw, I love you too, John.
Yeah, I have to say, Captain Spike is a hardcore fighting game player. Dandee says, I'm horrible at fighting games, but I still love them. Yay, someone like me. The best thing about fighters is that they have layers as you learn about the systems. It makes them accessible enough for a player of any skill level of skill, as long as they were equally matched. Good point. My first experience with fighters was Street Fighter 2 on the SNES.
Oh. Wow.
Dandee is very much like me. Various other ones throughout the years. More Street Fighter versions, Mortal Kombat series, Dead or Alive, Tekken. Might not be a popular opinion, but I love Tekken. Wow, Dandee and I are spirit animals for fighting games. It's mostly the weird characters and storylines. With DOA and Tekken specifically, I love the counter buttons. Make me feel like playing conservatively gives me an advantage and just makes you feel awesome. Something I don't get with the more subtle counter systems than other fighters. Very interesting, and you know, Dandee.
That's a really good thing that I hadn't really considered. We'll have to talk about that a little bit more next time.
Yeah, and you know, Dandee is a game designer, so it's very interesting to hear some of the designing stuff. Thanks, Dan. And last but certainly not least, Jeremy from the Koopa Club podcast said, I'm awful at most fighting games, but I tend to buy them nonetheless. I was pretty decent at MK9 and Injustice by Extension, but most Capcom games are a bit too fast-paced, I guess. The only Capcom fighter I was any good at was Tatsunoko vs. Capcom.
And I just want to say, it's really interesting that he said that, because a common complaint of a lot of the Capcom faithful with regard to Tatsukapu is that it moves, you know, a lot slower than the other versus games. The moves are a lot more deliberate. I see Seawolf Jason vigorously shaking his head.
Yeah, I thought it was a little too slow for my pace. But I enjoyed it still.
But for people like our buddy Jeremy, you know, that's just right up his alley.
Yeah, and in fact, I actually appreciate it for that. I still play that game because I love Marvel vs. Capcom 3. We're going to get to that next time.
Yeah, sounds like...
But when I want something slower and more deliberate and a little bit has a little bit more thought in each and every move, I play Tatsukapu. Mm.
Sounds like Jeremy will get a lot out of our part two of our fighting game discussion, I'm sure. And hopefully he did with the first one. Thank you so much for all of your answers to the Social Links question of the week. We have some quick general feedback to share.
And by the by, if you want to answer question of the week late, like you haven't responded yet, maybe you didn't see it before we recorded, by all means, please do answer. Give it the hashtag last week or something if you need.
Yeah, we'll read it.
Answer it on Facebook,
feedback.
And we'll still read it next week.
Yeah, we have some general feedback. I'll keep it quick. Crystal H from California says, I don't know why I said from California for her and not for anyone else. Crystal H from California says, I know I have said this before, but thank the gods for you guys. You are my sanity when work makes me crazy. I learn about games and get to smile or just lol. Oh, and there's a happy face.
No, I know I've said this before, but thank you, Crystal, for listening to us. You and Dan both are superb listeners. You give us a lot of really useful feedback, and we would definitely, I don't know what we would do without you guys. And thank you again for your amazing, amazing, amazing photo for our BioShock Infinite episode. We really appreciate that.
Love it. Nintendug said, thank you for making a heart with your hands. I imagined it in my brain space. Hearts with our hands again.
Jason, make a heart with your hand.
It's for Doug.
All three of us in studio are now making hearts with our hands.
We're giving you the power of heart.
Though mine more looks like a pear.
We're giving you two hearts and a pear.
Two hearts and a pear.
All right, with that, we love your feedback. If you would like to give us feedback, you can go to our Facebook. We love tweets from Twitter, as if you would get tweets anywhere else.
We effing love Twitter.
We also have Tumblr and Google+, if you're into those. You can email us. You can always find all of these links, our social links, at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org. That's also our main home base, and you can find links for all of the things that Slagkick just
including
mentioned.
Including a link to our iTunes page.
Yeah, please subscribe and leave us reviews. At this point, we're just going to keep doing this show for as long as we possibly can, probably forever. But still, we like to hear that y'all like us.
We understand if you use a different podcatcher, but if you're using iTunes, give us a comment. We feel great. Captain Spike, give some shout-outs to these folks.
So, as ever and always, if you're listening to us but you're not listening to Koopa Club, you are making a grave mistake. If you like what we do, you're probably going to like what they do. They're great. I can't really say enough good things about them.
Yeah, they kind of come from the same place of Retronaut-inspired realness.
Hopefully, we will get approved for our panel at Gamer X, and we will appear on the podcast Cross Zone with those guys.
For sure, for sure.
Obviously, I also want to shout out to Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and with whom I just so recently graced with my presence.
Lovely.
And, you know, obviously on there, I appeared with Rob Roberts, the main gentleman there. I think he's their main guy. It'd be funny if he's just like a side character.
Ah!
Whom we share screen time, by which I mean airtime, being catty hoes in Reading is Fundamental, the seasonal show where we sip tea and dish dirt on Logo's highest-rated drag queen competition reality show, RuPaul's Drag Race.
We should probably record another episode of that. It's been like a month.
Yeah, no, we should, because, hello, the season ends in a few days.
I feel like you're forgetting one very, very important shout-out.
Well, you know, I was going to give it out, but I'm going to let Jason do it. Jason, why don't you, in a couple of sentences, shout out your own show?
NPCs Only. It's a podcast about gaming from the GM, DM perspective for pen and paper RPGs. I know it's a little bit different than what we're talking about, but if you're
games is games, my friend.
But if you're into pen and paper RPGs and you kind of want to think about creating your own universe or characters or NPCs, we give a lot of advice from our personal experiences on what you can do, what you shouldn't do, how to make happy players. Me and
Space Pirate Ben
do the podcast, and in general, we have happy players. And it's about just...
We are happy players.
It's just about keep people happy and keep things fair. And you can tweet us at NPCs Only. And we have a Facebook page, and, you know, our blogspot is linked to our tweet, so you can just...
Yeah, Twitter is fucking awesome.
Yeah, just tweet us.
All right, I have a few shout-outs to throw at you before we leave. I have Game Bar. I want to take you to a Game Bar.
I want to take you to a Game Bar.
Of course, hopefully appearing with us at Podcast Cross Zone, fingers crossed. They're the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. There's the Nerdgasm Network, the wildest and raunchiest 3 hours of shock shock video game radio you'll ever come across. The best little horde house in Azeroth, the place for World of Warcraft views, but never too seriously. Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. And last but certainly not least, Video Game Outsiders, a podcast about video gaming from the average player's perspective. And we'd always like to shout out to Zelda Reorchestrated, who did our wonderful theme music. You know, we talked last time about how they'll be closing their doors, so go support them while you can. With that...
Well, my friends...
Oh, I have one special thank you that I think you have a thank you to make as well. Thank you to Seawolf Jason.
Thank you to Seawolf Jason. We really, really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to sit here and chat with us about fighting game design, theory, and history for 3 hours.
That was my pleasure. It was fun.
Excellent. I'm very happy to hear that. And hear that, everyone out there in Radioland. We're easy. You can totally be on our show and have fun.
Game Buoy After Dark.
Game Buoy After Dark. I love that you got in on that. All right, folks, as always, it's been our pleasure. In the meantime, we will talk to you again real soon. Keep gaming, keep thinking, and see you, Space Samurai. Thank you.
I have no idea what the Idolmaster Shiny Fiesta is.
That's a new Idolmaster game?
I have no idea what Idolmaster is.
I would get that, because it's like, it's a new Idolmaster game. It's like, I don't know what the fuck that is. What do you do?
It's that where you sing and you become an idol for Fiesta?
Oh, that should not even be here. We talked about that last week, remember? They released the Idolmaster games on iOS, and they're like $50 each.
Is that where you become a pop star or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're like, it's like a pop sim, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I know what game you're talking about.
You know Idolmaster.
I know what game you're talking about.
I forgot we talked about that.
What is the
that.
Fiesta edition? Is it like Espanol Mexicans be the hot salsa lady?
There's a Easter egg.
Maybe.